You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Thank you. When I was telling my wife about today's conference, she said, well, was I going to make a speech or just ask people to turn their cell phones off? So I said, well, both, actually. So could you please, if possible, turn your cell phones off? And now I know with this Taipei audience here, maybe you can turn them to mute at least, and if you need to pray under the chair in front of you, but hopefully not. My next piece of business is the following. As a nonprofit, independent, and nonpartisan organization, Brookings research, publications, and events are made possible by the generous support of a multitude of donors. Actually, if the multitude was a little more multitudinous, I wouldn't mind, but anyway, by a multitude of donors. Today's event is made possible in part through an unrestricted gift from the Clearinghouse, for which we are very grateful. Brookings recognizes that the value it provides is in its absolute commitment to quality, independence, and impact. Activities supported by our donors reflect this commitment, and the analysis recommendations are not determined by any donation. Our speakers today have a range of views, and they are encouraged to say what they really think, unconstrained by hurting anyone's feelings, whether mine or Paul Saltzman's or anyone else, and I'm sure they're going to do that. Okay, so that's the disclaimer at the front, but we're serious about it. Okay, a couple of opening remarks. I do want to join my colleague Doug Elliott in welcoming everyone to Brookings today for our conference on financial sector liquidity. Sometimes when Brookings gives has events, we refer to these as sort of being inside the Beltway issues, meaning they are somewhat of limited interest to the broader country. But liquidity is not an inside the Beltway issue or even an inside Wall Street issue because it affects all financial institutions and ultimately the whole economy. Unfortunately, it's not an issue that most people understand nor see the full importance of it. So I think it's very heartening to me today that we have such a great group of participants and a great audience to really dig into this important topic. Today you're going to learn a lot about liquidity, maybe more than you wanted to know about liquidity, but I think it's going to be a fun day. I got into really when I started my career, it was in macroeconomics in the 1970s. So I'm going to digress a little bit about how we end up where we are. At that time, the real scourge was inflation, and I participated a lot in the Brookings panel meetings with Art Oaken and George Perry in those days. And there was a very sort of vigorous debate around inflation and whether the Phillips curve was a valid concept. There was a shift towards rational expectations and the Lucas critique of the Phillips curve and the work of Lucas and Sargent. We still see a lot of that alive today. I think in a discussion we had earlier, Ben Bernanke was asked, well, how can people on the Fed board possibly think that hyperinflation is around the corner? And he answered that. My answer would be because we still have that monetarist view of inflation that persists to this day, which is not 100% wrong, but obviously has not been applicable to the world we're in at the moment. I think another way in which, in my view, macroeconomics took somewhat of a wrong turn was the real business cycle set of models. Again, I think we learned something from that digression, but I don't think we learned a whole lot about the kind of actual business cycles that we experience, which I believe to be largely demand-determined, demand fluctuations-determined. So this is by way of a preamble saying that, in my judgment, the economics profession was largely unprepared for the devastating financial crisis that we had. Now, it's not a new observation to say people didn't anticipate the decline in housing prices and the global spread of this crisis, and I understand, but I'm talking about something a little bit different, and that is whether we had, within our framework of macroeconomics, an adequate understanding of how the financial sector affected the macroeconomy, led to that crisis, and then subsequently, how we could get out of that crisis. Now, people may disagree with me. Don, I think, may be shifting in his seat and going to tell me that the Fed had, you know, a model that had a lot of finance in it, which it did. But nevertheless, I'm going to stick to that gun and say we really had a gap in our knowledge, a gap that we are still now trying to fill. And part of that, I think, is an understanding of the role of liquidity. And one of the consequences, I think, of the difficulty in understanding is why we've ended up with what some people call the sort of whack-a-mole theory of regulation, namely, if you see anything that looks risky, let's whack it because it might affect the whole economy. In his great talk last night, David Wessel sort of said, well, this is sort of pendulum effect. So the regulation was too easy, and then we had the crisis, and the pendulum swung too far, and now regulation became too tight. And I agree with that completely. But I think one of the reasons the pendulum swung is because of lack of ability to kind of say, here's how the financial sector works, and here are the pressure points that we need to address to make it safer, and you don't maybe need to press over there, and you do need to look at the combination of some of these regulations. And so we've ended up a little bit with overkill. So turning more to the question of liquidity, again, I think bank runs were certainly not something new, and we know from Walter Badgett that the right way to deal with these is that central banks should, quote, lend freely to solvent depository institutions against good collateral and at interest rates that are high enough to dissuade those borrowers that are not genuinely in need. And in the crisis, the Federal Reserve certainly did do that. They lent freely to solvent institutions. Arguably, maybe they lent to some insolvent ones, too. And the Treasury lent capital under the TARP program. In fact, the Treasury lent to the big banks whether they wanted the money or not. So it's not news to say that this financial rescue was not particularly popular, and Congress reacted to this fact by putting restrictions on future lending. Indeed, they said never again to some lending, such as the Fed's support of money market funds, and then Dodd-Frank placed restrictions on the 13-3 exigent circumstances lending by the Fed. So following both the letter and the spirit of Dodd-Frank, the Fed and other regulators have now made it clear that banks are expected to provide their own liquidity and not come to the Fed for funds, even in times of moderate stress. Maybe real heavy stress is a different story, but that still, I think, remains to be seen. Basically, the idea is to tell the banks, you've got to carry your own liquidity and not rely on the lender of last resort. I remembered the other day hearing Barney Frank talk about some of these issues. He was giving a speech at an Urban Institute dinner, and Annette Nazareth and I were in the audience and were heckling him a little bit because he was going off about the need for these restrictions on Fed lending. And he had been offering a lot of praise to the Fed and to the Treasury for having saved us from the crisis. And as Annette and I said, and now you want to take away the powers for them to do it if they have to do it again. But he was pretty adamant about that, and I think he was reflecting the sentiment in Congress, which was that Congress controls the purse strings, and they don't think the Fed should be able to make some of that lending without the permission of Congress. Now, the ability to get the permission of Congress in the middle of a crisis is a matter of question. But here we are, then, with some restrictions. Arguably, they're not as tight as they look. Some restrictions on the ability of the Fed to lend liquidity. And certainly, regulations now that are going to make it make banks required to hold their own liquidity to be able to last 30 days under stress without need to access that liquidity. Okay, with that preamble, I think today's conference is going to examine those issues from a number of dimensions with a lot of very distinguished panelists. So it's 9:15, and I'm going to get out of the way, and we're going to have our first panel, which is moderated by David. Thank you. No.
Good morning. I'm David Wessel. I'm the director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here. It's good to welcome you all. I think one thing we've learned is, from looking outside, there is such a thing as having too much liquidity.
I was going to make that joke.
I also think it'll be required that every panel begin by referring to Walter Badgett for good reason. I think Walter Badgett, maybe his admonition about lending in a panic that Martin referred to, may be the only thing in central banking that hasn't changed over the last 100 years. I always like this quote from Badgett. A panic is a species of neuralgia, and according to the rules of science, you must not starve it. The holders of the cash reserve, the central bank, must be ready to advance it most freely for the liabilities of others. They must lend to merchants, to minor bankers, to this man and that man, whenever the security is good. We have an extraordinarily distinguished panel today. We could do a whole conference with the panelists I have the pleasure of introducing this morning. Because my last name begins with W, we're going to do this in reverse alphabetical order. Our first speaker will be Don Cohn, who's a colleague of mine here at Brookings, of course the former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, and importantly a member of the Financial Policy Committee of the Bank of England. He'll be followed by Mark Flannery, who is the Bank of America Professor of Finance at the University of Florida and has a title to which I aspire, Eminent Scholar Chair in Finance. Then John Dugan of Covington and Burling, of course, the former Comptroller of the Currency. Daryl Duffy, who's the Dean Wetter Professor of Finance at Stanford University's Business School. And finally, last but not least, Charlie Calamiris, the Henry Kaufman Professor of Financial Institutions at Columbia, who is spending some time at the moment at the IMF, and who, lest you think he's appointed head academic, is actually the chairman of the board of a small bank here in D.C. Each of our panelists has agreed to speak for 5 minutes, and my colleague Sarah Holmes is going to try to hold him to that, and then we'll come up here and have a discussion and take your questions. So, Don Cohn.
Thanks, David, and it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to a very, very interesting day. I'm going to focus, I guess, to some extent on Badgett's this man and that man, so lending by central banks to non-commercial banks, that liquidity provision and the restrictions that were put on that in Dodd-Frank. I think it's a critical function of central banks to lend to prevent or limit financial panics. Badgett's thought was that by lending, you limited the fire sale pressure on banks and other financial intermediaries, and that would limit the damage. Certainly, the Federal Reserve in 2008 and 2009 opened the discount window to a wide variety of counterparties, but I'm concerned that the restrictions that were put on 13.3 in the Dodd-Frank Act limit, and limit more than is wise, the ability of the Federal Reserve to take those actions again. So I start with the premise that non-bank financial intermediation has become and will continue to be an important source of intermediation in the U.S. economy. I think particularly, it certainly was important a few years ago. It's been of growing importance over the 20th century and into the 21st century, and as we restrict bank intermediation, make it more expensive, there's more is likely to flow out to the non-bank sector. The old 13.3, the lending to individuals, partnerships, and corporations by the Federal Reserve was already pretty restricted. We could use it to limit the damage from runs, and I think we did limit the damage from runs on non-banks, but we couldn't prevent or forestall the panic. The vision of the people who founded the Federal Reserve was that just having the Fed there would reassure people and you wouldn't get panics. You couldn't do that with we couldn't do it very well with banks. It was even more limited for non-banks. There were two restrictions in 13.3. One is that the situation had to be unusual and exigent before the Fed could make a loan. That implied a very bad situation just to open up the window. And secondly, related to that, that whoever was borrowing couldn't get credit elsewhere. So you already had to have a bad situation before you opened it up. The new 13.3 in the Federal Reserve Act, lending to individual partnerships and corporations, retains those two restrictions and adds a few more. Now, one of the restrictions it adds, the Fed sought, and that was a restriction that you couldn't lend to failing institutions. The Dodd-Frank set up another way of dealing with that, but there were three more restrictions that I think you wonder about, even facilities, broadly available facilities for non-banks, whether those won't be less effective. One, it requires the approval of the Secretary of the Treasury. Now, when you get into a crisis situation, you want the Treasury along with you, but this does bring a political, the potential for a political influence and a political decision that overrides the Fed's technical decision about what's necessary. Second point is there's a lot of emphasis there on security and assurance of repayment and collateral and the value of collateral. One of the things that Batchett says is that the central bank should not chase collateral values down. The central bank should value the collateral as it would be valued in a normal time. Otherwise, you just keep adding to the problems. The really important facility that the Federal Reserve had in the last crisis was the commercial paper facility. There was no collateral behind that, right? There were fees that build up. I don't know whether the Fed could do the CPFF again. And the third issue that concerns me is transparency. So anybody that borrows from the Federal Reserve, any individual partnership or corporation that borrows from the Federal Reserve, their name goes up to the Congress within 1 week. And the Federal Reserve can request that name be held confidential. But if I were a potential borrower, I don't know how I would view that. I mean, a problem with the discount window that limits the ability of the discount window to do what it's supposed to do is stigma. People don't like to borrow. They don't like to be seen as borrowing. They're afraid that it will become known in the markets. And this adds now, I think, political risk to market risk. So I am worried that the new 13.3 would be even less effective at carrying out Badgett's vision of what a central bank should do than the old 13.3 was. Thank you.
Well, I'd say thank you for inviting me, but I only have 5 minutes, so I can't say that. David's been very clear. The whole regulation that we've gotten, proposed regulation, related to liquidity coverage ratios, derives from a notion that in 2008 there was excessive maturity or credit information intermediation. And so we're trying to cut back on that. That's the notion. Now, I was new to this. I spent a lot of time thinking about capital regulation. But last week when I started looking at the liquidity regs, I was surprised of two things. First of all, I was surprised that I didn't see the banks prominently saying, this is going to cut back on lending and raise the cost of lending and increase unemployment and kill jobs. And second, I was surprised that there was no pro forma Basel paper that said, don't worry, there won't be any downside to these liquidity regulations. And that made me think that these things had not, and at least I couldn't find, a careful cost-benefit analysis about whether, in fact, cutting down liquidity and maturity transformation in the banking system was a benefit that was worth the costs. So I came at this, you know, sort of with the first question being, why do we want to do this? And I have not yet found an answer that's anything like the answers, good, bad, or indifferent, that we've seen in terms of the capital structure. But it does seem to me that that's an issue that people ought to think about. The second issue is whether we ought to do this through quantity restrictions or price restrictions, sort of the Weitzman notion. And the path has been quantity restrictions. And even assuming that we want to choke off private liquidity and maturity intermediation. It's not clear to me that this isn't a rather coarse, blunt instrument that we're about to put in place with the LCR and the net stable funding ratio. Where does this transformation happen that caused trouble? What happens in the banks, the IDIs, insured depository institutions? It happens in shadow firms or securitization arrangements, the shadow system. And it happens in bank holding companies outside of the depository institution, so the non-bank subs. Now, the first thing to think about is the banks. Why do we want to put portfolio restrictions on banks at this point when there's a discount window available to them? And so Jeremy Stein, not surprisingly, had an extraordinarily insightful speech that he gave just about a year ago in Charlotte. And he said, look, if there isn't a social cost to using the discount window, then why don't we just use the discount window, because that's an easy way, and that's what Badgett said, and that's what, if you read Charles Goodhart's 1990 book about central banking, he says the same thing about what the discount window is for. So it seems to me that I actually think there are some costs to using the discount window beyond stigma, and that is that it rearranges the priority of claims on the bank's assets, that by pledging collateral to the Fed, the unsecured claimants on the bank are actually worse off, and they have more incentive to run after than before. So, you know, people call it stigma, but it seems to me it may be rational. So we have to think about whether we can rely on the discount window and why we're drawing the line between discount window access and self-finance the place we are. Now, the shadow intermediation, I believe that if we restrict this intermediation in the regulated sector, it's going to go somewhere else. Historically, that somewhere else has relied on bank liquidity guarantees. So maybe the thing to do is to put special liquidity requirements on liquidity guarantees to securitization if we want to cut that down in the private, in the shadow sector. But certainly the way the LCR is constructed, that's much more coarse than just trying to get at the shadow intermediation that perhaps was too extreme. And then finally, within the bank holding companies, the non-bank parts of the bank holding companies, that's where the 13-3 restrictions that Don was just talking about are most appropriate. And there, maybe the liquidity ratio is appropriate for the non-bank parts of the bank holding company. There remains the question of whether pricing as opposed to quantity restrictions would be the way to do it. I had one sort of crazy thought that I'm sure the bankers will love. If you want to get at the liquidity transformation in the non-bank parts of the bank holding companies, then change the bankruptcy law so that for information-intensive assets, the bankruptcy stay doesn't apply to a repo transaction. So for treasuries, it's fine, but so I've read some stuff at the New York Fed that they're sort of thinking about where the bankruptcy stay ought to apply and not. And that would be another way to address maturity and liquidity intermediation outside the banks, inside the holding companies. So to summarize, I'd say I've got a question about the cost-benefit analysis. I've got a question about whether the LCR and the net stable funding ratios are too broad and blunt. And finally, it seems to me that the capital ratios and the liquidity ratios ought to be related to one another in the sense that if you take more liquidity risk by having a lower LCR, you ought to be able to compensate with a higher capital ratio elsewhere. So those are some of the things that occurred to me in the last week. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here, and I will be brief with my introduction as well, to get to our 5 minutes. So I thought what I would do today is build on some of the remarks that have already been provided, but start with the assumption that I think is implicit in everything we've talked about, that liquidity was absolutely critical to the problems that we faced in 2008, not just with respect to the broader economy, but it was the thing that potentially was failing financial institutions, didn't have enough of it. Less about solvency, more about liquidity. And so the notion that we have to have adequate government tools to deal with liquidity remains critical. My scorecard on the liquidity tools of the government is as follows in the wake of Dodd-Frank and actions that the government has taken since then. That we preserved three really important tools. We added two more and we took away or severely restricted for others. And I'm going to go through these and then just give you a very quick take on what I think we should do in addition to that. The three that we preserved are, one, discount window lending for depository institutions, including on an individual basis. Same thing, we preserved deposit insurance for depository institutions, not always thought of as a liquidity tool, but clearly it was put in place to address liquidity problems. And third, as we just talked about, we preserved some aspects of the emergency discount window lending to non-depository institutions, particularly on a program-wide basis, subject to all the restrictions that Don talked about. These are all very powerful tools, some of which got developed in the crisis, but they all also have very significant limitations. Then Dodd-Frank added two more liquidity tools, I would say. One is, for failing large institutions, it added the orderly liquidation fund, a source of temporary emergency liquidity used to resolve a failing large financial institution. Very powerful tool, very important to Title II of Dodd-Frank. And as Martin already referred to, there are the new requirements that essentially require banks to self-insure financial institutions by holding more liquidity. We certainly didn't have enough of it in the crisis. Holding more, I think, is a good thing, but it also has potential collateral consequences that you're going to hear about later today. And then, I think, in response to the political pressures, there were four important tools that were removed or severely restricted. One was, in the heat of the crisis, the Treasury Department used the Exchange Stabilization Fund, theretofore used for currency problems, to guarantee money market funds to stop the run on the funds. It was, by the way, extremely effective, and as was referred to earlier, it was a little bit like the fire department putting out the fire and people saying you did a great job and then outlawing the fire department. So they took away that tool, admittedly a big stretch of its power to be used in that circumstance. The second one that I think has not gotten as much attention as it deserves is the FDIC's systemic risk exception power to provide assistance to open institutions that are in some way connected to a bank. This was a tool that was added in FDICIA a long time ago when I was a junior staffer on the Senate Banking Committee, but it was stretched and massaged in ways that proved extremely powerful during the crisis. And in particular, it was the source of authority for the Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program that allowed the government to guarantee the balance sheet and the issuance of new debt by financial institutions in concert with similar actions taken by governments around the world. It was a tremendously powerful stabilization tool that proved very successful and, by the way, very profitable to the FDIC. Congress essentially took that away by requiring congressional approval to put that into place. The third big cutback is what Don was referring to as the restrictions on emergency lending to non-depository institutions, one he didn't focus on. I believe it's going to be much more difficult, even if you satisfy all the restrictions that he pointed out, to lend on an individual basis to a company, even if it has severe problems. And then finally, this was less a Dodd-Frank issue, but it's really an important thing that maybe hasn't gotten the attention it's deserved. One of the tools that supervisors use to address a problem with a big institution that's having a liquidity problem and so it doesn't spread is to encourage a stronger institution to buy the weaker institution and to use government assistance to do that. That is going to be very difficult to do in the future because of all of the strings attached and the penalties and enforcement actions that have been taken with respect to the legacy assets of firms that have acquired these institutions in the heat of crisis. I just don't think that will happen again, or it will only happen if the government provides such open-ended guarantees about losses that will come later that it's hard to imagine the government being able to do that. So that, I think, is my basic scorecard, and I might take just three quick points. I think there are some things that where they went too far, and there are three things that ought to either be restored or added. One is, I mentioned the Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program, the ability in a crisis to guarantee new debt issued by financial institutions. I would restore the ability to do that without congressional approval. I think there's pretty broad consensus on that point. Secondly, like Don, I am very nervous about the cutback on emergency powers, particularly with individual firms. I recognize the controversy and the problems associated with providing emergency lending to non-banking firms in a crisis, but it worked. And we don't know what the future will bring. And I can assure you, in the height of the crisis in 2008, people did not know what was going on. We used every tool at our disposal. We twisted some things and expanded them more broadly. And it was really important to address some unknown things and unanticipated things that happened. And I think we have to have some break-the-glass authority to deal with problems in the future. I would say I think it's an open question whether the Fed by itself should be called on to do that because it's so controversial politically. You may need to have the involvement of the White House, even if it brings in the politics we've been talking about, just because it's such a political kind of decision. And then lastly, the point I'll leave you with is I believe that the runs on the financial system that started the crisis in 2008 did not emanate from the traditional side of the banking system, but instead emanated from the broker-dealers and the investment banking side that were not at that time as connected to the banking system as they are now. There is still vulnerability by these, the short-term wholesale funding of broker-dealers. We don't have an adequate tool to deal with them directly. I think there should be serious consideration given to providing them the kind of liquidity that are provided to banks. I know that's quite controversial, but and that it's an expansion. But I think if you had that ability, you would be in a better position to deal with a truly problematic broker-dealer that was about to fail, and it could fail, because healthier broker-dealers would be in a position where the problems wouldn't necessarily spread to them because they would have access to such a facility. It would come with a price. There would be regulatory restrictions that would have to be proposed, but it's a part of the system that I think needs addressing. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks, David. Before I got up here, I thought I might be the only one that was going to grip the third rail of financial regulation, which is should 13.3 be extended to non-banks, individual non-banks. 13.3 has allowed for broad coverage of areas of the financial system that would include, for example, the primary dealer credit facility. But like Don and John, who came before me, I'm going to grip that rail. I'm going to talk about why I think 13.3 has been overly limited, overly limits the ability of the Fed to provide liquidity to individual non-banks. And I'm going to focus my remarks on the securities and derivatives markets, particularly non-bank broker-dealers. And I'm going to ask the question, what is it about emergency lending that should not apply to these? Are they systemic? Surely they are. Could they fail from an absence of liquidity? Yes. So why wouldn't we extend 13.3 to individual non-banks? The situation that we have today puts the Fed in a very difficult position, conditional on a systemic liquidity crisis at an individual non-bank. The Fed would, at least if it reads 13.3 as I read it, need to sit on its hands until that systemic crisis spreads to a number of non-banks that are suffering from a similar liquidity problem, allowing the crisis to spread. I want to mention briefly there is a specific instance under Dodd-Frank in which a non-bank could be given emergency liquidity. That's the provision for financial market infrastructure under the Clearing Supervision Act. The Fed can step in for a central clearing party, for example, and provide emergency liquidity under Section 806B, but only under very limited circumstances, including the contingency that all private market sources of liquidity have been exhausted. So essentially, given how quickly things can happen, I don't think the liquidity might be quick enough. Let me return to broker-dealers, though. Yes, they are systemic. The United States, among all national economies, surely would recognize that securities and derivatives markets are systemically important. The United States has far more provision of credit and risk transfer through broker-dealers than any other major country. So it's ironic that the United States is limiting 13(3) from those sources of liquidity risk. Let me address the arguments that have sometimes been made against providing emergency liquidity. One of them is that macroprudential regulation will take care of this problem. We don't need it outside of the regulated banking system. Well, that certainly didn't apply before the last financial crisis. Macroprud didn't work very well. Securities and Exchange Commission, while it does a good job in many areas, I don't think you would say macroprudential regulation of the broker-dealers was a high point in its macroprudential supervision. And it is true that individual systemically important non-bank firms can now be designated by the Financial Stability Oversight Council for some degree of supervision, but the primary responsibility rests with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and I hope that they do a very good job, but I wouldn't want to rule out the possibility that one of those could get into trouble. The other argument that's often made is moral hazard. In my view, macro-pru is the best defense against the moral hazard problem. You force shareholders through capital and liquidity requirements to bear the costs of avoiding a liquidity crisis. I don't think moral hazard on its own is going to be an effective tool in mitigating the likelihood that a firm will get into trouble. The metaphor that comes to mind is whether you would be willing to send your teenagers far offshore in a sailing boat without life jackets. Here, the life jackets is the liquidity from the Fed, under the with the idea in mind that if they don't have life jackets, then they'll probably be quite safe because they're going to hug the shore and avoid getting into trouble. I wouldn't do that. I would require the life jackets. In the current environment, we are seeing a significant amount of credit provision outside of the regulated banking system in the United States. Just a couple of days ago, I noticed that Jefferies, a broker-dealer, managed to beat out Morgan Stanley for a very large leveraged loan. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a number of non-bank affiliated broker-dealers become more systemically important and at some point be a source of concern. We shouldn't be thinking of lending of last resort as something other than what is to be used in the contingency that one of these firms gets into liquidity troubles. I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to start off with some basic ideas and look forward to the discussion. But I want to start somewhere where my colleagues didn't start, which is defining what a liquidity crisis is. And I want to emphasize that this past one, like every other one, is always an insolvency crisis. There has never been a liquidity crisis that did not emerge endogenously as a result of substantial increases in insolvency risk that drove the funding liquidity problems, the inability of intermediaries to roll over their short-term debts. The Dimon-Dibig model or any other conception of exogenous, that is, shocks to liquidity that don't come from insolvency, that is a model still looking for an example. And this last crisis certainly was not the example. What happened, of course, is that from roughly April 2006, when bank holding companies and other intermediaries had their peak of their market value of equity to market value of assets, That declined roughly from the spring of 2006, gradually, usually, until by September 2008, when that ratio looked very, very low. For example, Citibank was 13% in April 2006, market value of equity to assets. By September 2008, it was about 2%, which is the insolvency point, given the put option value of too big to fail and deposit insurance. In other words, Lehman was a match in a tinderbox of insolvency risk. So what liquidity crises are and always have been is insolvency crises. The olive green one there is the Citibank line that I was just describing to you. And, of course, the obvious error that the regulatory and political process made in the crisis was not reacting to a more than two-year gradual decline in the creditworthiness of financial institutions, which was clearly visible and which was known by the market until it was too late, as people saw the signals increasing of the larger exposure of these institutions over time. We finally got to the breaking point in September. Okay, so that's what a liquidity crisis is. It's an insolvency risk problem, a counterparty risk problem that leads to a funding illiquidity problem. What are the implications? Well, obviously, as Mark already pointed out, although I say it a little bit less nicely, the separation of liquidity and capital standards is idiotic. They are two different ways to affect insolvency risk, and insolvency risk is the whole game. What's needed is a framework that talks coherently about how they trade off and what the limits to the substitution between liquidity, that is cash on your balance sheet, and capital on your balance sheet are. And I want to point out that I do have with some co-authors, one of who's here from the ECB, Florian Heider, some theoretical ideas about that. And the key things I would point out to you is, from the standpoint simply of insolvency risk management, cash is extremely useful. First of all, it's not an accounting fiction. Cash at the central bank, unlike capital, is not an accounting fiction. So it's extremely useful because it's really a buffer that you can rely on. And secondly, it has some really favorable consequences for risk management. Okay, so now that we've diagnosed the problem and pointed out that liquidity regulation's main role should be special advantages of liquidity regulation for limiting solvency problems, I want to now come to the basic question. As the other panelists have pointed out, we've limited our interventions into liquidity risk problems, and the question is, the absence now of sort of blanket guarantees of debt or recapitalization schemes orchestrated by the Fed, is that going to be a problem? So the case against the view that it's a problem is, well, if we had good enough capital and cash requirements, not just macroprudential but microprudential, then maybe we can get by without this problem, without these other interventions. And I have some ideas about how we could improve the regulatory environment to make capital and cash standards sufficient and reliable from a dynamic standpoint so that we would never get back into where we were, where we allowed Citibank's market value of equity ratio to fall from 13% to 2%. That, to me, was the basic mistake, and it is avoidable. But ultimately, I'm going to come out where my other panelists came out. And I want to point out a few things about why I'm skeptical of the Badgett rule approach. First of all, Badgett's rule is a myth. The Bank of England didn't use Badgett's rule. In fact, no central banks have ever relied entirely on Badgett's rule. For example, the resolution of the Barings crisis in 1890 by the central bank, the Bank of England, was done through credit guarantees, not through collateralized lending. The resolution of the Mexican crisis of 1908 also was done through a kind of interesting, complex credit guarantee approach. Central banks pretty much haven't really relied on collateralized lending as their main tool throughout history. So we have this misconception that Badgett's rule is enough. Probably isn't. We also have some pretty good examples from history that tell us that other kinds of interventions can be very useful. I would point out that in the 1930s, the use of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was a pretty good ad hoc device. So my view, which echoes what previous people said, is having something, instead of delayed sort of use of something while we reinvent it, having something on the shelf that we kind of agree could be used would be very good in avoiding delays and politicization relating to the actual event What exactly that should be isn't so clear. We'll talk more about it. What role should the central bank have in this? My own view is not much. This should be done through, as the RFC was, for example, done through something outside the central bank, because I think it's the consequences of the politicization of the central bank, which we're living with right now, are not desirable. So that's the summary of my conclusions, that first of all, liquidity regulation has to be about insolvency risk, because liquidity crises always are about insolvency risk. Cash does have some unique roles, and we want to really take those seriously, which I'm not hearing much in the debate, unfortunately. And then finally, I am cognizant of the fact that, as many other people have said, even when we think we've solved problems with microprudential or macroprudential, it's likely not to be enough. So it would be good to have something on the shelf. Thank you.
There's a microphone on the chair if you need help. Well, I want to start by really thanking the panelists for taking my advice to keep it short so we can have a good discussion among ourselves and involve you before we're done. I'm kind of startled that there appeared to be a consensus emerging. I thought that wasn't supposed to happen until the third panel. So is everybody here agreed that when we think about the Fed and its lender of last resort function, that too much restriction has been put on it? Do you think that, Mark?
Yeah, I do. I think I forget who said it. I think John said there ought to be some break the glass power.
Right.
That sounded right.
And Charlie, you think maybe someone else ought to have it, but
yeah,
I'm
a little concerned about giving fiscal authority to the Fed and credit subsidies, which are what these guarantees are, or recapitalizations. So I think that Bear Stearns was an unfortunate episode that we don't want to repeat, and we don't want to put the Fed into this role of being sort of the lightning rod of all the politics. So I think you might want to have such an authority, and we should think about it and construct it and not destroy the central bank again.
But I thought that one of the points of liquidity was that if you're running a strong bank and Citibank looks insolvent and there's a run on your bank, that we ought to have some way to give you liquidity even though you don't have a solvency problem. You didn't seem to entertain that as a big possibility.
Well, I'm not saying that it's not possible. That confusion, that liquidity crises have two pieces to them. One of them is an insolvency trigger, which is an event. This is mortgage-backed securities, for example. And then the question is, what is your factor loading? How big is your exposure to that shock? And there can be a lot of confusion about that. So I'm not saying that there isn't potential for confusion and that solvent institutions can be confused with insolvent ones. But what I am saying is that if the banks had not been allowed to get their market value ratios down to very dangerous levels, that sort of confusion wouldn't have been relevant for their ability to roll over their short-term debts. But that said, as much as I believe that we could solve the problem with microprudential regulation, that I still am echoing the views of others that there are other kinds of events that come up outside the banking system that might be relevant, and it would be nice to have some kind of rules in place in advance about what we would do, but not necessarily in the Fed. In fact, probably not.
Yeah. I agree with that last point. I think for that really extraordinary event that's super political, I think it is a lot to expect the Fed to bear that and to bear the political consequences that would come from it. I mean, I think during the crisis there was a lot of discussions with the White House and others about, isn't there any authority that you have to deal with? And the answer was no. And you'd want the administration on the hook for this very political decision for some very significant emergencies, I think.
So I think Dodd-Frank made a differentiation and should have made it even stronger, which is, for sure, if you have a failing institution or one that looks like it's insolvent, then you have to go through orderly liquidation. And that was a tool we didn't have during the crisis. There just was no choice in Bear Stearns and AIG, et cetera. But now when you get to the rest of the market and you, and the confusion is there, and the fire sales that mount up, the difference between liquidity and solvency in a crisis is very fuzzy, because the lack of liquidity forces sales of assets that drive down prices that make institutions that that would be solvent in more normal times, and even if those MBS were valued at reasonable levels, even reasonable low levels, but when everything gets sold and you got the fire sales, there has to be a way to come in and Tim Geithner called it spreading foam on the runway, right? Somehow protecting the institutions and limiting the fire sales beyond the bad institution, which I agree is a political fiscal decision.
And you think, let's say we extend the discount window to broker-dealers in some form or another. So that suggests to me that the Fed would have to have a lot more regulatory authority over broker-dealers, or at least supervisory authority. Is that practical?
It's currently happening under FSOC-designated broker-dealers.
Right.
But conditional on a problem there, it's Section 23A of the Federal Reserve Act prevents liquidity coming through the bank itself into those bank-affiliated broker-dealers.
Right.
So the logical conclusion is that if only one of them is having a systemic liquidity crisis, you need to stop it. It's called emergency liquidity because there's a timing issue here, and that waiting for some sign-off that's potentially politicized is not what you want to do. You want to go afterwards, review the whether, in fact, there was some excessive fiscal authority used. The Bank of England was forced to appear in front of the Treasury Select Committee after providing emergency liquidity to justify its actions, and I think that's completely natural in the case of emergency liquidity to a non-bank.
Now, what about looking at this from the bank's point of view? So, as I understand it, the regulators have decided that the banks need to have more self-insurance. And the question is that necessary? Is it a good idea? And have the rules gone too far? Do people have a view on that?
When you say self-insurance, I think...
Hold more liquidity than
yes,
they otherwise would.
So, but not necessarily liquidity. Again, you know, capital and liquidity. And thinking about this in terms of counterparty risk and a systemic shock. I mean, what happened was a really big shock was allowed to erode the counterparty quality of the major intermediaries. And over time, as that happened, without being corrected, it ultimately led to their inability to roll over debt. So how do you fix that? You create a resilient system. In other words, something that would have told banks, it's not acceptable for your market value of equity ratio to fall below a certain amount, and when it starts to fall there, you have to issue new equity. And the markets were wide open from September of 07 to September of 08. $450 billion of capital was raised in the markets. The reason that the banks and the investment banks didn't raise more was because they didn't like the price, and they had the backstop protection. So I really want to emphasize we could have done a lot better, and we could, with some creative mechanisms that Mark and I have been advocating, we could do a lot better.
But should the banks be required to hold more cash? Have we gone too far?
My view is yes, that I would like to see, and I know that people are going to think it's excessive, but I think that requiring banks to hold, let's say, about 10% of their assets as equity, 10% as a new kind of COCO's bond, and also a 20% cash reserve requirement relative to assets remunerated at the Fed funds rate and held at the Federal Reserve on a 24/7 basis, I think that would be a good start.
What are other people? What do you think?
So I'm not an economist, but all that money that you're holding is not going to work in the economy. And there is a trade-off. At some point, you have a place where the self-insurance is a great idea. They're much safer, but they may not be doing the job they're supposed to be doing with funding, intermediation, and economic growth. I don't know where that trade-off is, but I think you can get there, and I'm not exactly sure what the trade-off is, but we should be very conscious.
And do you think we're on the wrong side of that, or do you know?
Well, I think, on the other hand, I think during the crisis, we clearly did not have enough liquidity, so we had to do more. It's calibrating how much is enough is a very difficult thing. We're in very new territory on liquidity in particular, and honestly, I don't know. And I think that your panel later today is a nice segue or tee up for them. That's what they're going to talk about with the LCR and the net stable funding ratio. But that trade-off is absolutely critical to bear in mind.
Right. So I get the trade-off. I'm trying to figure out, do people have a view about where we are in the balance?
I don't think we've gone too far. I think until we have more capital and more confidence in our risk-based capital requirements, which we're still fiddling, that liquidity is minimum liquidity requirements are a very natural requirement. I don't think they've gone too far at all.
I want to emphasize that the current Basel formulation, these two ratios, is not what I'm proposing at all. And I worry that those are actually taxing liquidity production by banks. It's not the same as requiring a cash reserve requirement at the central bank. I don't want to go into why, but it's very different. Cash, not just longer-term debt, is a very effective regulatory tool because it's a real buffer in a way that capital might not be, book capital might not be. So it's really not what we mean by liquidity regulation has been hijacked by what I consider nonsensical Basel ratios that say things like covered bonds or liquid assets and, you know, other kinds of really undesirable regulatory changes. We need to get back to cash. I would also emphasize under the National Banking Act, under clearinghouse rules, what was the prudential tool that was always used? It was the cash ratio, not the capital ratio. We didn't bring that until 1981. Cash ratios. It's like a margin requirement, right? So, and a lot of people talk about 100% cash banking. You don't really need 100% to get huge advantages in terms of downside protection. And it doesn't necessarily stop you from lending because you can always increase the scale of the bank with raising more capital too. Yes, it does have a cost, and you're right, but it's not like it's a prohibition on lending. Banks can scale up.
Mark, do you think we've gone too far?
I do. I think that this LCR stuff is just a complete mare's nest in terms of deciding what the runoff assumptions ought to be. I think that it's doomed to get lost in the details of political fighting between the regulated and the regulatees, and I guess I don't see a lot of benefit to it. You know, if there's some chance that I'm going to lose all of my liabilities, holding 20% of those liabilities in liquid assets doesn't really help. If it's going to be bad enough, if it's a solvency issue and everybody's going to run against me, but more than that, I look at the level of assumptions and the level of calculations that people have to make and defend as plausible. And I think that it's just a horribly burdensome regulation.
You mean the liquidity per se or the whole panoply of regulations?
I meant the liquidity part of it. It's just, you know, anybody could argue easily with the notion that 3% versus 10% of insured deposits will run off within 30 days. I don't know where to get that information in a way that I could rely on it. So I just think it's a really difficult set of regulations.
And you raised the good question of weighing costs and benefits. And the costs of asking the banks to hold too much liquidity are?
Well, they're going to, for any given portfolio size, they're going to have less lending. They're going to do less of something else. Where's it going to go? We don't know, but it's going to go somewhere. And so I think we run in this and in the capital regulation case, we run the risk of winding up with safer banks but a less safe financial system, and doubly less safe because we haven't got mechanisms in place ex ante.
It seems to me you're making two different arguments there. One is they will lend less, mm-hmm. and we have to decide, is that a good trade to have a more stable financial system?
Exactly, yes.
That's one. And then the second is the one about the perimeter. Obviously, if you have only one set of institutions that are regulated, the stuff migrates to the shadow banking system. We'll just recreate Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and money market funds again. And I haven't heard anybody express a view that that's a good idea. Don, where are you on the – do we make – doing too much to make the banks or not enough?
I don't think we know yet. I don't think right now I think we've done too much. I think we need to let the process work out, see where it ends up. But I do have the same concerns that you just expressed, David, that if we are going to make the banking system safer, we got to make sure we're not making the financial system less safe by having the stuff migrate elsewhere and do maturity transformation and leverage in ways that are less transparent. As happened in the 2004 to 2006 period, private investors didn't understand what they were getting. The issuers didn't understand what they were issuing. There was a lot of very risky banking going on outside the banking system. A lot of that was regulatory arbitrage, if you think about the sieves and the conduits and whatnot. So I think we have to be very careful as we implement these regulations on capital and liquidity about what's going on outside.
But I would want to emphasize something that, remember, what I'm talking about is really almost like a Treasury bill holding requirement.
Right.
But that's held at the Fed. And if you look at the post-World War II period in the U.S., the ratio of Treasury securities held by banks as a proportion of their assets has been pretty high on average. Recently, it's not been as high. But I don't think it's such a strange thing to require them to hold effectively 20% of that. And I would also say, in response to what Mark said, actually, if you know, I'd like the opportunity to convince him, a 20% requirement actually could do a lot of good in terms of insolvency risk, particularly if combined with the higher capital requirement and a COCO's requirement. So it's the combination of them that I think is. So I'm looking at it more from the standpoint of it really wouldn't be that unusual to tell banks that they have to have 20% of their assets in treasuries.
But what about the non-banks? You're going to.
Well, that's where it gets tricky, and I share the concerns here that if you make this too punitive, then you're going to start creating problems. Right now, we're already seeing this, and I think the insurance industry is one of the big problems. We're seeing problems in the pricing of variable annuities, that is, too aggressive pricing. We're seeing insurance companies getting involved now in agricultural land, not to mention unbelievable terms, unprecedentedly loose terms, in commercial real estate funding on loans. So I actually think we're already seeing a fairly frothy environment in commercial lending coming from shadow insurance.
So, Mark, you think if the banks had to hold 20% of their assets in T-bills or cash, that we'd have that would be a good thing? What would be the downside of that?
Well, again, I think the downside is that, first of all, there's less intermediation going on.
Right. That's part of the point.
That's the point. That's the point. But I guess I don't have a strong sense for where to stop.
Right.
Okay? And 20% seems like a lot. You know, Charlie, the banks have held a lot of treasuries, but I'll bet a lot of them are encumbered by repo obligations. So this requirement is for unencumbered treasury holdings, which may be quite different from what is shown on the balance sheet before.
Daryl, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role that bankruptcy plays in this. There is, from time to time, calls. If we could just get a better bankruptcy regime, we wouldn't have to put ourselves through all this stuff. And then there are other people who say, yeah, great. That worked out so well with Lehman Brothers. We want to do that, make that a regular part of our thing. What role does bankruptcy play in this, and how could we use bankruptcy more effectively in these situations?
Well, first thing we could do is to change current bankruptcy rules so that we tailor some chapter of the bankruptcy code. There's a group of scholars that at Penn and at Stanford that have been working on what's called Chapter 14 that's designed to more quickly handle a systemic financial institution that's failing. The second thing we could do is to clarify the treatment under bankruptcy of what are called qualified financial contracts. So currently there are issues, not as much in the U.S., but in the U.K. with the swaps books of broker-dealers in the U.K., which have more than half of the global swaps. These swaps terminate at any insolvency, and under U.K. law, there's nothing restricting swaps holders from collecting collateral and destabilizing that financial institution. So I think the U.K. authorities need to do something with their insolvency regime to avoid destabilizing systemically important firms.
Hmm. Don, you look like you were either agreeing.
The international aspect is really important here. So I guess I think that it would take reform of bankruptcy all over the world to make this happen. We probably have better chance of using the Title II type interventions and coordinating that than we would coordinating bankruptcy laws around the world. So I think even with a reform of the bankruptcy code, which might be helpful to pick up some more firms, there'll still be a role for an orderly liquidation authority for the government, as the FDIC has done for depository institutions for decades. Let them do that for really systemically important institutions that really can't be handled very well by the bankruptcy code, even a reformed one.
I agree with that.
Yeah, but even if you had a perfect bankruptcy system and a perfect Title II, you're still going to have runs and systemic questions and liquidity issues well before that that require tools.
Right.
And for example, the things that Don talked about in his remarks about more systematic, programmatic things that we did during the crisis with respect to commercial paper and the like, those kinds of tools are really important to get to prevent something from, metastasizing and causing a lot of other institutions to fail. You have to have those tools.
Can you talk a little bit about why you feel so strongly that eliminating the FDIC's ability to guarantee bank debts, it was a mistake? And then I'd like the other people to respond.
So during the crisis in October of 2008, when at this point it had spread and there were confidence problems all over the world, and governments were looking for things to really try to stabilize things and to staunch the bleeding with respect to healthier firms more generally, and so that people would have more confidence and not just hoard cash and hold on to things. And the notion that governments were standing behind balance sheets of banks as they issued new debt made it possible for them to do so. And that was done on a coordinated basis. People still looked at, to some extent, the balance sheets of the companies. There still were some differentials, but it was an enormously powerful thing to keep markets open. And we did it using this kind of coopered together authority that nobody thought would be used for such a circumstance, frankly. But it worked really well, and it staunched the bleeding, as I mentioned, and was very profitable to the government. I think widely viewed as successful. And now, in the legislation, Dodd-Frank, in order to do that in the United States, you have to go get express approval from Congress. And that's just something that's too difficult to do. It's too much of a hurdle in the middle of a crisis, in my view, and I would.
Right, and Charlie pointed out that this has been done for decades, this idea.
Yes. Well, there are many different ways to do it. And,
would you recommend restoring that authority?
I'm not sure. I think I'm thinking about this right now. I'm writing a paper with two other people, Mark Flandre and Luke Lavin, where we're surveying what 20 different countries' lender of last resort authority rules have been from 1970 to the present. And one of the examples that I'm kind of looking at and thinking is interesting is the Canadian example. So Canada specifies three tiers of interventions, and then it has particular triggers that have to be satisfied to go from one tier to the other. And, there's also a substitutability between a recapitalization strategy and a debt guarantee strategy. So, there's some interesting economic questions here, and I'm not sure that debt guarantees on a blanket basis are the best way to do them. So, for example, when the Bank of England was faced with this problem, coming from a shadow bank called Barings, which was an investment bank in 1890, it created exposures for the London clearing banks. And so it told the London clearing banks, well, tell you what I'll do. You guys put together a fund to guarantee Barings, and I'll provide backstop to that. One of the pieces that we don't do anymore, but which was very much used historically, was to take the banks and have them get together as a group and have to bear sort of first loss in dealing with systemic risk episodes, and then have the government backstop them, which is like Bagehot's rule in the sense that the government...
Sort of like LTCM.
LTCM, yeah.
Yes. And so, but the...
But not well-received.
But not, not
that
quite.
That was popular.
Because, I think that... I'm not ready to tell you right. What I think the right answer is, but I'm saying, there's more substitutability here than you'd think. It ultimately, because illiquidity problems have an insolvency basis to them, a lot of the solutions can deal with guaranteeing insolvency,
right.
And you can do that in some very... So, for example, Chuck Schumer in September 2008 suggested that we might bring back the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Now, I think if you had done that in September 2008, instead of squander several months before we really had any...
So TARP, you got TARP in September, September 2008.
Well, no, you didn't get it in September. I don't think you got
October.
It.
October, yeah,
yes.
Beginning of October.
And,
third week of October.
And furthermore, it really wasn't implementable as the Treasury Secretary originally designed it. So you didn't really get anywhere for months. And so I think if you had actually moved with even an old-fashioned preferred stock recapitalization, if that had been on the shelf and bring back RFC, which is what Schumer was saying, I think that might not have been such a bad idea.
But the big recaps were done in October of 2008 using TARP with 10 banks. That's what
Don, correct me if I'm wrong. So there's it would be nice, I'm sure, if you were the central bank and the OCC and the FDIC, if Congress said, as a result of this crisis, we're going to put a whole lot of standby legislation on the books. You can have an RFC, and you can have bank guarantees, and you can have all, and you guys choose which one you want if we have a crisis. My judgment is the chances of that are somewhat less than zero.
And I'm not suggesting that. But look at the Canadian example.
Right,
there's specific.
Don, yeah. But Don, correct me if I'm wrong. It seems to me that both you and John Dugan are saying that the problem is that these panics can come on you very fast, and they may happen in ways that you don't anticipate, and that you're, I'm putting words in your mouth, you were generals on the battlefield. Don't tell us what we can and can't do and think that you can manage this.
It's very hard to anticipate, A, what's going to happen, and B, what's going to work in order to stem it. So I think a fair point with Fed liquidity facilities is we tried a whole bunch of them. Some of them got no action whatsoever. That didn't work. Mm-hmm. But you kept trying until you found something that stemmed the panic. So it's very hard to say. I think Charlie's on to the standard playbook in a banking panic is capital and guarantees. And I take Charlie's proposal is having both of these available to the authorities, I also take your point, David, getting that done, getting it on the shelf, even with very difficult triggers, is going to be extremely hard. I thought a really adverse effect of the crisis was people equating loans with bailouts. So it had been so long since the 1930s. That people forgot that what a central bank is supposed to do is make loans against collateral to stem the panic. And doing standard central bank stuff was termed a bailout, even though in the end it was. I mean, in the end, obviously it stopped the panic and people got loans they couldn't get in the markets because the markets weren't operating. That's exactly the point of it. But, In the end, that's people lost track of what central banks were really supposed to be doing.
I want the rest of you to respond to a point that Don made here and he's made previously, that our drive for endless transparency creates a stigma that then leads the institutions to be reluctant to do what is not only in their interest but in our joint interest. I always have a hard, I mean, you warned about that early, right? And then you kind of lost that argument with the Congress on over the stuff. And yep. As I recall, most of the blowback was people were, or some journalists were shocked that there's actually foreign banks that can borrow from the Fed, which had never occurred to them before. Apparently, they'd never used their HSBC ATM card or something. I thought the joke about the rain was better than that one. do the rest of you worry about stigma, or is that just Don fighting the last war? Darryl?
I thought during the 2008-2009 period, stigma didn't end up causing severe problems for the Fed, partly because it was using auction-based
credit
facilities. And, you know, broker-dealers and banks that could appear to be simply competing in markets for profitable opportunities rather than harming themselves. So in a general financial crisis situation, I don't think stigma has turned out to be a problem. In a one-off where a bank needs to go to a discount window, I think there is a severe stigma, and if it's not a general crisis, that that it would be reluctant to do so until it might be too late. Hopefully that's not going to be more than a one-off.
I think there were stigma issues in the crisis. I think people were really reluctant to go. I think it was partially addressed by creating these facilities that were designed to address stigma, and it addressed a lot of them, but not all of them. I think there were individual firms, I know there were individual firms, very reluctant to use them for word getting out, and I think it's a problem whenever you're designing these credit facilities to try to address stigma. I don't think we've gotten rid of that problem. I do think it's still there.
Let me think for it.
Well, I think that the Fed took a lot of steps to try to minimize the stigma. And it's always, the stigma's always been a little bit of a puzzle to me as well, because the discount window tends to be a pretty good deal when you go there. So it's always been a little bit of a puzzle to me why pledging your collateral for the lowest price
should be stigmatic, if that's a word.
But I think if you looked back on it with the records, that the U.S. firms that used it was actually pretty low, the traditional discount window, as opposed to the foreign firms, which, as you pointed out, not many people knew what was going on.
Right, right.
But the U.S. firms were very reluctant to use it, and they had to create these other facilities that were more open and where there was cajoling going on to get obviously healthy firms involved to try to get rid of stigma. So it was still...
Right. I mean, Mark, it may not be rational, but... You know, the amount of press you get when you took anything from the government
will
certainly make you think twice about doing that.
I'm not saying that because I don't understand that it's wrong. I'm just saying I don't understand.
I mean, I'm not sure I agree with the answers that others have made. One thing that is striking, of course, is how much in September the liquidity hoarding behavior of banks changed. So, in other words, they certainly were... don't seem to have been thinking that they wanted to rely on central banks. So I'm not sure. There are a couple of interpretations of that huge change in September, which, by the way, happened in Europe as well as in the U.S., that there's a qualitative change in the accumulation of excess reserves that's happening at that time that I think is at least consistent with the view that they didn't want to be in the position of relying too much on the lender of last resort. There may be other interpretations.
Is that a bad thing or a good thing?
No, I'm just offering that as an example. If you were trying to see, is there any reason to think there might have been a stigma problem?
Right.
That
right.
at least is consistent with the.
It would
point.
Be a bad thing if the banks stop making loans even more than they otherwise would be
right.
stopping making
right.
loans in order to accumulate liquidity. So, yes, I think that would be part of the downward spiral. I think that is a bad thing.
I think it's a good time to turn to questions. Do we have mics?
Here.
Okay. Why don't you go down in the middle on the aisle. Do me a favor and tell us who you are and try to remember that questions usually end with a question mark. That goes for you too, Bert.
I always ask questions. Bert Ely, a banking monetary policy consultant. I want to come back to something that I think Charlie came close to touching on. That's this whole question of solvency. When is an institution solvent? How do we know it? Don Cohn said something along the line, well, it looks like it's insolvent. It seems to me that that's a major issue here in a crisis, is who is solvent, who is not, and it is exacerbated by mark-to-market accounting. So my question for the panel is, in a crisis, in an environment where you have mark-to-market accounting and all of the transparency associated with it, how are the regulators supposed to determine who they lend to and who they don't, or does precaution go out the window and you lend to everyone whether they're solvent or not?
Can I?
Sure.
So my first answer to that is we really don't care about the existential question of the ultimately whether, in God's eye, a bank is solvent or insolvent. Because what makes a systemic crisis happen is when the market sufficiently doubts the solvency of the institution. So that market value ratio that I was pointing to really is what you care about, because of enough significant institutions have low market value ratios, that means that's a sufficient statistic to tell you that their counterparty risk has gotten a lot worse, and that's going to create a funding liquidity crisis. So I really believe that as a first sort of tool, we should be looking much more closely at market value ratios and making sure that they aren't allowed to get very low. So I think keeping market value ratios of banks and all large intermediaries that are subject to this kind of liquidity risk above a number like 9 or 10% would be a great way to avoid having to lend or assist insolvent institutions. But that indicator should have been relied on a lot more by the regulators. I know that they were aware of it, but they weren't reacting to it.
Don, how hard is it to tell in a mark-to-market world whether an institution is solvent and should be allowed to borrow from the discount window or not?
It's very hard to tell because you don't know what the real prices of those assets are going to be in 6 months or a year, whether the prices you're seeing on the market today are indicative of the underlying value, or if you lend to them and get them through this period and get the markets calmed down, they'll be plenty solvent. So it's very hard to tell. I think in some cases it's pretty clear that there's hardly any imaginable rebound in asset prices that would make a particular institution solvent. But there are a lot of borderline, and you don't have very good up-to-date data. That's another problem. To some extent, you're sitting there looking at last quarter's call report and trying to make adjustments to what you see. So knowing whether an institution is solvent is very difficult. I think Charlie's point about earlier intervention, making sure there are ways of building that solvency is exactly right. And that's what the stress tests are about, and that's what COCOs are about. So having bail-inable capital that bails in while the institution's alive, not just bail-inable at death, will help to keep that market, the solvency up there.
And I assume it matters if it's a one-off in a time when the world is calm and if they're all going at once.
Yes. If it's idiosyncratic, fine, let them go. But when it's part of a broader thing.
I was going to say that I agree with what's been said, but I think the reputational concerns of the Fed are something of a mitigant against that. The Fed is going to be taken to account afterwards if it lends to insolvent institutions, and its risk management of its own reputation is to some extent going to mitigate this issue.
Just one other point that worries me that nobody's brought up yet. Most financial crises that have ever happened that involve banks relate one way or another to real estate. And right now we're in a situation where, because of financial innovations and securitization and the migration of different kinds of bank lending outside of the banking system, we now have a banking system that has an unprecedented concentration of real estate risk. Large banks, about 50% of their loans are real estate. Small banks, about 75%. That is, as one economist said, the business cycle is the housing cycle. And so you've got this very systemic sort of characteristic. This is going to be coming back. We have to be thinking about this deeper problem that I don't have an answer to, which is, which I think is all the more reason we need to be very careful about our prudential standards. But another issue is so much of banking risk is systemic risk.
There's a question over there. There's a mic coming behind you.
Hi, Phil Wallach from Brookings. Thanks for this discussion. It's been really great. I'm wondering if someone on the panel can try to put themselves in Congress's shoes and give a little bit more charitable interpretation of their reactions to all this. You know, we've sort of heard about them shutting down all these tools that proved really successful and useful during the crisis, and it sort of comes off as just sort of a mystery. But so what pressures do you think Congress was responding to in making those changes? I'm especially interested in the change in the EESA to that exchange stabilization fund, you know, with the money markets. That was such a successful thing. But they didn't tell you that you couldn't use the exchange stabilization fund for other purposes, sort of left it there for another day for uses to be determined. What's going on in Congress's head? What kind of accountability are they looking to produce, and you know, what should they be thinking about in those terms?
Well, let me just respond to one thing on the exchange stabilization fund. Every time the Treasury uses it for something, the Congress then outlaws it. I mean, they did that with Mexico after Mexico. So on that one, I think we know what it is. They don't like the idea that the Secretary of the Treasury has some kitty he can use to do something. And remember, in the Mexico case, the Secretary of the Treasury used it for something that Congress was asked to approve and couldn't get its act together. So I think that's what. Who wants to volunteer to be a congressman and not kill himself?
Well, I just want to say that I think...
I'm looking forward to your campaign, Calamaris.
I don't want to put myself in the shoes of Congress, but I think that their actions speak very clearly. Even in the TARP legislation, they made very clear that they wanted to do something, and they insisted on something I thought was very counterproductive, which was to make sure that assistance to banks was viewed as profitable in terms of the right options, and they had Warren Buffett envy. That's not the purpose of bank assistance, is not to make profit. So why did they insist on that? People hated the banks. They still hate the banks. Any politician, and we saw this with Tim Geithner. Tim Geithner in March of 2009 came up with a pretty good idea
about bank assistance that was related to some stuff Ricardo Caballero was writing about and I was writing about, and it lasted about 2 weeks. He sent that up the flagpole, and people said, you know, you must be kidding. So there are fundamental political realities that come down to things like hatred that politicians reacted to that were very counterproductive.
I think if Tim Geithner were here, he would put it slightly differently. He would say that these rescues are inherently unfair, that in a financial crisis, innocent bystanders get hurt, and in order to protect them, you have to appear to reward the arsonist. And that is, members of Congress, many of whom wouldn't understand a word that we've said here this morning to begin with, found that an overwhelming concern.
That's what I was trying to say, I guess.
I was suggesting that saying something's unfair doesn't require hatred.
Yeah, well, I would add one other thing. There's a huge, long-standing populist strain that this taps into about the unfairness of banks being treated differently and preferentially. And it's an interesting thing because in other cultures it doesn't necessarily end up that way. So if you talked to the Japanese, for example, everything we've talked about having more self-insurance in terms of holding more liquidity, holding more capital, is designed to avoid being in a situation where the government has to use some extraordinary powers. But it also could mean you'd end up with less intermediation, less lending than is desirable. And I think some other cultures will take the position that if you have a big problem, that is when the government should step in. And if it requires some nationalization of companies, then that's what they'll do. And in the meantime, you have an ability to provide more intermediation to the system. And it's not obvious that our view is right, but it is a huge political component to it that is different here than it is in other places.
Yeah, further to that, I want to recommend Charles' book with Steve Haber, which helps us understand how the attitude of legislatures towards their banking systems is very country-specific and historically dependent.
Okay, let's take, there's three questions here. Let's take the two women here and first, and we'll ask them both questions, and then we'll get to Paul.
Thank you very much, Barbara
Matthews.
Some
water.
BCM International Regulatory Analytics. I'd like to congratulate Brookings and the panel for a breath of fresh air on the liquidity rules. I've been watching them with some alarm for the last 4 years, having been in the trenches on the details over the last 4 years, not to mention previous incarnation. It's a very helpful engagement to shed some light on how the framework can operate or not operate, as the case might be. I have two questions.
Okay.
I was surprised not to hear a key component of liquidity provision to banks not be mentioned. If you lived through this, but I read the transcripts from the crisis era, the central bank swap lines did a great deal to provide liquidity to banks not technically domiciled or headquartered in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're talking about the liquidity rules, it's an international negotiation, even though the authority is domestically domiciled here.
Right.
And so not discussing the central bank swap lines, how they operate to provide stability and liquidity. I feel there's a missing component. Maybe we'll talk about it later.
Okay.
Maybe you'll talk
and
about it.
And your second question?
My second question is the international spillovers as well. And it's actually to Professor Calamir specifically. You have a great deal of faith in the COCOs as a provider of stability. I'm wondering, why do you not believe it will accelerate liquidity pressures when the triggers get pulled, no matter who pulls it, whether it's the private sector or the government?
Okay. Could you pass the microphones behind you? We'll take that question, then we'll answer them, and then we'll...
Thank you. My name is Haley Boesky. I'm at Bank of America, large U.S. bank, which I think you've all heard of. So, but in any case, thank you very much for organizing this. Thank you for inviting me here today. Much of what you said was music to my ears. I think much of what you said really hit on some relevant, very important issues, of course, except for the 20% capital requirements and 11% leverage ratios. But in any case, one of the things that I wanted to address was actually to the point that you raised earlier. I had actually the pleasure of sitting side by side with many people in this room and Tim Geithner during the crisis. Tim Geithner would say what you had suggested he say, but he also said something that I think is one of my favorite quotes. If you want to know who caused the crisis, look in the mirror. So in my view, and you said, you know, he would have said that the banks appeared to be favored in the bailouts or in the response to the crisis. But I think one of the things that I'm very concerned about is the impact of all this regulation on credit intermediation, and that was resonated through all of your comments. Mm-hmm. And you look at numbers that came out today, almost no growth in this country. And I'm worried about, you know, yes, Congress has a very short-term view, and there is a lot of anger towards the banks, but there was the education process wasn't there. And they're very concerned about addressing their constituents over sort of a very short election cycle, if you will, and not really thinking about what their right sort of responses might be over a much longer term cycle, which has an impact over the generation. So I ask this very esteemed panel, how do we address that? Okay. How do we, like, everyone raised great points today, but what can we do about it?
Okay, so let me break these in three pieces. The first, Don, can you talk about, so during the crisis, there was an innovation, really, where the Federal Reserve lent a lot of dollars to other central banks so that they could lend dollars to their banks, which were long dollar assets and short dollar supplies, or maybe I got it backwards. Anyways,
right.
How does that fit into all this, and how important was it?
Well, I think it was very important, and it fits in because it gives dollars to the other central banks then to extend them through a lender of last resort, through a discount window kind of facility to their banks. The other central banks, the primary regulators, are in much better position to judge what the need of the bank is, whether it's solvent or insolvent, what the liquidity is, and judge the collateral that the bank is bringing. So I think in a sense the Fed allowed the other central banks to make those loans with dollars, with being guaranteed by the other central bank. Where it got difficult was when it went beyond the industrial world. So we did establish swap lines with, I think, four emerging market economies, and that was very hard to figure out which ones and to say no to some and yes to others. I think it would be much better if the IMF were in a better position to make those judgments rather than the Federal Reserve.
And just to be clear, nothing in Dodd-Frank limits that from happening in the future?
I don't think so,
right?
Not that I know of.
And there was a kind of reverse stigma here. It was seen in the world as being, if the Fed would do a swap line with you, that must mean you were a grown-up country. And if you had to go to the IMF, it means the Fed rejected you.
Oh, and the IMF, of course, there's countries don't like to go to the IMF because there are all these conditions they go through, and the Fed didn't put conditions on these loans. The IMF is trying to devise lines that, and has devised lines that don't have that kind of conditionality, but there's still a reluctance to go to the IMF. So I think the IMF is still working on its role.
But the Fed loans were collateralized.
Well, by the other central bank.
Right.
I think that there's a, it wasn't an unconditional loan in that sense.
It required collateral, but it didn't. It wasn't conditioned on
behavior.
The behavior of the banks, right?
Right. John, you've dealt with Congress a lot, so I think what Haley is asking, I'm going to rephrase her question. So, we know one way to have long-run planning in government. That's kind of the Chinese model. If you don't have to get reelected, it's pretty easy to take the long run. May not be in your people's interest, but you can take the long-run perspective. What observations do you have about how our democracy, how our Congress could do better at dealing with these trade-offs between the anger of the people and the long-term interests of the economy and the people? 25 words or less.
Oh, boy. You know, I think there has to be a certain amount of patience in respecting independence of agencies, and I think they did make an important distinction, right? They said, we really don't like helping individual open banks that are in trouble, and they drew that line. I think there was basically consensus on that point, provided you had the tools to deal with and resolve. And I think what they ended up doing in Title II, as added by later interpretations to create the single point of entry thing, is a really powerful good thing that they ended up with. And so, you know, there are some places they went that I think they went too far, that is the inevitable political response in our country to this, and I think you're going to have to expect. But there are places that they did some quite responsible things. So it's always going to be a mix. I think the thing that I find most troubling is usually you have that period, intense heat, and then over time things cool off and you can do some technical amendments and make some adjustments and changes, and we're seeing none of that.
Right.
And I think that's problematic because this is so big, so unwieldy, so many issues. You'd like to be able to have a credible debate to make some adjustments and to fix things. And there'd be some things that got wrong. We're just not having them.
Right, not limited to Dodd-Frank.
Correct.
And, Charlie, the question about are COCOs just a trigger for... Why don't you explain what COCOs are first?
I remember the question. So first I want to acknowledge that Mark Flannery really, in my view, was the first person to articulate these really good ideas in reaction early to this crisis. And I think the key point, at least of my incarnation of this idea, is that you don't want to have bail-in COCOs, which have the problem you're talking about. You want to have market-triggered, very high equity ratio triggers, so that when a bank is contemplating this, they can avoid it. They can avoid the triggering by doing voluntary issues of equity into the market, so that this becomes like a thermostat that just keeps that equity ratio higher, and the COCOs never convert. They really become like a senior debt instrument. And also, I think at Goldman Sachs, some people, Steve might want to talk about it, also developed similar ideas a few years ago. So I think there's a fair amount of agreement that as long as you structure these with a sufficiently high trigger and in a dilutive way that encourages the banks to be proactive in responding to them, that what they really achieve is just keeping that market value ratio high.
Mark?
Yeah, I think a lot of the things we've talked about today almost exclusively are what happens when things have gone wrong and we've gotten to a potentially insolvent situation. And Don's comment that at that point it's very hard to tell who's solvent, I think that's a point that we've got to deal with. And so the response I've come up with, I think it's really important, I agree with Charlie in this, that we just don't get to that point. Mm-hmm. What you have to do is you have to have a mechanism at a relatively high capital ratio where the firm is clearly solvent, and you got to have a mechanism for keeping the firm more than adequately capitalized in economic terms. There are a range of questions about market value and anticipations, but I think if as long as we stay away from 2% market capital, 12% book capital, what the hell does it all mean? Then we're in much better shape, and the problem needs to be addressed way before all the things that we've talked about in terms of last minute lending.
Paul Saltzman? Why don't you wait for the mic, Paul?
Sure. Paul Saltzman from the Clearinghouse. I was just struck by Charlie's, what I thought was a very profound statement at the outset that no one really seemed to comment on. Charlie, if I get your observation correctly, I think you said something to the effect that liquidity risks are really manifestation of insolvency risks.
Correct.
And I just wanted to question that a little bit. Are you really saying that there could be no exogenous liquidity crisis without some insolvency crisis? For example, 9/11, Y2K. I mean, you know, those were examples where the Fed stepped up and we had no insolvency. Activity restrictions, Volcker rule, proprietary trading, de-risking, deleveraging. I mean, you could have a host of exogenous circumstances that create liquidity pressures independent of anyone's triggering insolvency. Those may trigger an insolvency, which again creates a sort of whatever the opposite of virtuous circle is. But I was just curious as to, could you maybe restate your original sort of thought and then maybe get some commentary whether people agree with that? Because I thought that was pretty profound.
Well, I want to be careful about definitions here, but yes, I'm going to stick with my comment, which is that illiquidity is always, in every crisis I'm aware of, is a manifestation of what amounts to a loss of confidence having to do with solvency. However, some of the shocks that you're talking about can become insolvency related. So, but let's take the most obvious place where these problems you're alluding to will come up, and that's in emerging markets. So let's take, for example, the Russian crisis and its effect on Brazil in 1998 and early 1999. So you could say, why did Brazilian sovereign debts, dollar-valued sovereign debts, decline so much in value in the wake of the Russian crisis. What kind of shock was that? And I would say, well, that was a problem where the same intermediaries that were holding the Russian bonds were also holding the Brazilian bonds. They got stuck with a solvency problem. Their solvency problem forced them to have to liquidate some assets, and the only ones they could liquidate were the Brazilian ones. So now you have a massive flow of Brazilian debt onto the market. From the standpoint of innocent bystanders who are holding Brazilian sovereign debt, that was an exogenous shock to their solvency, and it was coming from a solvency problem of the intermediary that was holding the two. So, but my point is it always comes down to some market value change of underlying securities that have ramifications on people's solvency, even though the initial shock can be something that sounds like there was no shock to Brazilian solvency, and yet there was a solvency problem relating to holding Brazilian. I don't know if that was helpful, but so, that's an example.
But that sounds like liquidity. So,
but Brazil, there wasn't any question about Brazil's solvency.
That's my point. But right. the problem, yes.
So I thought it was a question of externalities, that right. Why should, if just because my bank happens to begin with the letter C and Citigroup begins with the letter C, and there's doubts about Citi's solvency, I thought the role of the central bank was, if people get confused and they go to the wrong bank with the bank of C, then the Fed should lend me money. But there's nothing I can do as the other bank to build my reputation in the marketplace, my solvency, to avoid that. I'm being affected by the insolvency.
But it doesn't really work out that way. Even if you looked at the asset-backed commercial paper crisis in August 2007, the characteristics of only about 40% of the commercial paper was forced not to roll over, and that had identifiable characteristics in the market. The real estate betas of banks had a lot to say about which banks suffered the most. Banks didn't all suffer the same declines in their equity values. J.P. Morgan Chase didn't suffer the same decline as Citibank. So it's not all sort of impossible to figure out. There were identifiable characteristics of banks that were associated with relative differences. In fact, I think it's a really important point that Renee Stoltz and others made, that if you look at the cross-section of which banks were hit in 2008, it looked a lot like the cross-section of 1998. In other words, there seemed to be risk management deficiencies that were bank-specific that the market knew about.
Well, Mark, just one question. I do think there were instances of things that markets could have been overreacting to perceptions of insolvency that didn't occur. And the one that sticks out in my mind is Wachovia. There clearly were it was a really open question, tremendous amount of uncertainty whether we needed to resolve them that weekend. There was a feeling we did. There was worries about their liquidity, although they had $100 billion in liquidity on their balance sheet, and it was all about a perception about whether it run. Government acts, thought they needed to do an assisted transaction. Turns out, bidder comes in and says, you know what, we think it's a really good franchise, we'll do it without assistance. So
it was a little complicated than that, but yeah.
Okay, I get it. I mean, yeah, absolutely right. But I think there, and our examiners definitely had this feeling that it was way exaggerated as to what their actual financial health was, and in the end it's proved to be a quite lucrative transaction for the acquirer. My point is it's not such a clean line.
Right. I think we'll end it. I want to thank the panel for what was really an interesting conversation. There's coffee outside, and we reconvene here for the next panel at 11 o'clock, so that's 10 and a half minutes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. And I have to say, I thought that was a terrific panel, so congratulations to David and all of the panelists. So it gives us a bit of a high hurdle here for the second panel. What we're going to be focusing on in panel two is that while there's broad agreement that we need the Fed or other central banks as lender of last resort, I think there's also quite broad agreement we don't want the lender of last resort function to be used all that often. And therefore, we need to make sure that banks and perhaps other important financial institutions maintain sufficient liquidity. And so this panel will focus on the rules intended to ensure that there is adequate liquidity at the banks. So we have a great panel of experts to explain and debate these issues. You have bios in each of your packets, so I'm going to only very briefly introduce each one. After I walk through a few introductory slides, because there is a chance some of you don't actually already know these rules, though it's a pretty knowledgeable crowd, I will say, from people I know here. So I'll go through a few introductory slides, and then we'll start with Mark Vanderwide. He's a deputy director in the Division of Banking Supervision and Regulation at the Fed. He'll be followed by Mark Sadenberg, who's a principal in Ernst & Young's Financial Services Office, and he was previously at the Fed for 15 years. Paul Ackerman will follow. He's treasurer of Wells Fargo, a small bank you may have heard of. And finally, we'll end with Adam Gilbert, who is a managing director at J.P. Morgan, who focuses on regulatory policy. And thank you to each of the panelists for joining us. So I'm going to just briefly introduce the topic, and then after I finish, we'll bring the panelists up on the stage and have them go through one by one from the podium. So I think it's pretty clear at this point, particularly after the financial crisis, that liquidity does matter. Banks have always been vulnerable to runs because they make multi-year loans, which are illiquid, and they do it using deposit funding. And we've had, as banks have expanded their activities and as non-banks have joined in to similar types of activities, it's expanded beyond just that narrow issue, but you still have long-term loans or other important assets funded by short-term funding. So lender of last resort function is intended to protect against runs like that, but we do want banks to handle most of the liquidity needs by themselves because we don't want the lender of last resort function being called on very much, and we want to reduce the problems that are caused by fire sales prior to the lender of last resort stepping in. It's also clear that banks were too illiquid prior to the last financial crisis. Liquidity regulation was really pretty loose, and there was no equivalent of the Basel capital standards, which created more quantitative, globally agreed standards. Liquidity seemed abundant, and it felt like it would always be abundant, that there had been a sea change from earlier years. And banks, therefore, you can argue reasonably sensibly, decided not to increase their expenses in order to improve their liquidity, because liquidity does cost money. You either give up some investment income by shortening your assets, or you pay more for your liabilities in order to get longer-term liabilities, since there's usually a yield curve where longer-term assets and liabilities have higher yields than short-term ones. So to deal with the illiquidity problems that we have observed, certain new liquidity rules are being put in place, and they've been foreshadowed a bit in the first panel, but I just wanted to touch on them for those of you who haven't followed this as closely. There's a liquidity coverage ratio, or LCR, which is part of the Basel III agreement. That's the global agreement on capital and liquidity standards. And that will be effective as of 2015. It's also something called a net stable funding ratio, and I'll tell you more about these two. That's also part of Basel III and comes into effect in 2018. In addition, there are liquidity stress tests akin to the capital stress test that we have now that the regulators are applying. And in general, there's going to be more careful liquidity supervision in addition to these quantitative tests. So the liquidity coverage ratio, as I view it, is a stylized stress test. You basically postulate a 30-day period of intense liquidity pressures in the financial markets, and then the quantitative formulas have you try to estimate whether banks would have enough cash to last through the 30 days. So you assume that on the one side, funding sources will dry up to some extent, so some of your deposits and even more of your wholesale funding will go away, and that the assets you were planning to sell to raise cash won't be worth as much in a crisis, so you'll have a haircut to their values. On the other side, we assume that there will be more needs for cash than in normal times. Your corporations will come and draw down on their credit lines, for example. And so the idea is you need to have at least 100% of the required funding in order to pass this. The net stable funding ratio is intended to tackle a somewhat different issue. So the LCR is this stylized stress test. It looks like an emergency situation. The NSFR is intended to deal with longer-term structural issues where maybe some banks have relied too much on short-term funding for their long-term assets and have created a situation in which problems could occur. So there you look at the available stable funding. So you essentially say things like deposits from retail customers are pretty stable, so you want to treat them as pretty valuable. On the other hand, some other sources are likely to go away to some extent, so you give them a lesser credit. And on the other side, you look at what portions of the credit lines might be drawn down. You look at haircuts on securities. So again, a little bit like the LCR, but it's trying to look on a longer-term basis for that. So those are LCR and NSFR are terms you're going to be hearing in this panel. And at this point, we can put the lights back up again, and let's bring up the panel members. And we'll go through one by one. So if you could all come up front. And I'll just ask that you each speak from the podium when it's your turn, starting with Mark Vanderwide.
Thanks, Doug, and thanks for the invitation to participate in the conference. I thought in my remarks today I would first offer some views on why liquidity regulation of banks makes good policy sense as a general matter, and then make some comments about the specific framework of bank liquidity regulation that the Fed and global regulators have developed in the wake of the financial crisis. I apologize at the outset to the extent that the first piece of my presentation treads on ground that might have been well trod in the first panel, but I find it hard not to start from first principles. Before I say any more, let me make clear that my remarks today are my own, and they may or may not be articulate, they may or may not be edifying, and they may or may not reflect the views of any governor of the Federal Reserve System. Let me start with the metaphysical question of why we need bank liquidity regulation. Following the hallowed traditions of microeconomic theory, I think this question roughly translates into what is the market failure here that we're trying to solve? Or more specifically, why can't we rely on each bank to self-insure against its own liquidity risk? Or failing that, why can't we rely on interbank markets or on the private sector more broadly to provide needed liquidity to solvent but illiquid banks? As Governor Stein explained in an excellent speech on bank liquidity regulation last year, the business of banking involves maturity transformation by definition, and therefore banks are inevitably exposed to various forms of run risk. In response to shocks, the relatively fragile funding structures of banks can result in rapid cash outflows that lead them to fire sell assets, to fail, or both. And fire sales and bank failures can have substantial negative effects on other financial firms and on the economy as a whole. So banks will naturally keep on hand some amount of liquid assets to deal with potential unanticipated cash outflows, but banks are unlikely to hold the socially optimal amount of liquid assets, because while they bear all the costs of holding those liquid assets in terms of reduced profitability, they do not capture all the social benefits in terms of enhanced financial stability and lower cost to taxpayers in the event of failure. It is also not clear that we should substantially rely on interbank markets, interbank funding markets, to prevent or ameliorate bank runs. Most fundamentally, it seems imprudent for policymakers to assume that other banks will be willing and able to lend to a solvent but illiquid bank that's under liquidity pressure. Information asymmetries are part of the problem. Healthy banks are often loath to increase their lending to a stressed bank because of its opacity. It's hard for a healthy bank to determine whether the stressed bank is solvent or illiquid or insolvent. A second problem is that the financial conditions of large banks are strongly correlated with each other and with the condition of the broader financial system. And this correlation has been increasing over the past decade. As banks have gotten larger, more interstate within the U.S., more international, more interconnected with each other, and more internally diversified as the Glass-Steagall walls have come down. In other words, when one large bank is stressed, it is often the case that all or almost all other large banks are stressed. In part for these reasons, the interbank funding markets in 2007 and 2008 were not exactly a material source of strength for stressed banks. If you agree there's a market failure here, it seems you have two principal options for addressing this failure, simplifying a bit. The first option is central bank lending to solvent but illiquid banks. The second option is bank regulation. These options are not, of course, mutually exclusive. Central bank lender of last resort facilities should clearly be part of the solution. Some have argued that they might be the complete solution. According to this view, if you assume a well-functioning regulatory capital regime for banks, the central bank can always avert fire sales and bank failures ex post simply by serving as a lender of last resort. But I believe there are good reasons to not rely exclusively on central bank lending to address bank illiquidity, and good reasons to think that social welfare can be increased by attempting to conserve on use of the lender of last resort. And I'll give three reasons why. First, we can't ignore the fact that there are legal limits in the United States on who can borrow from the Fed. Most notably, the Fed's firm-specific discount window is only available to depository institutions. It's not available to broker-dealers, to non-bank lenders, to asset-backed commercial paper conduits, to money market mutual funds, et cetera. And Section 23A of the Federal Reserve Act prevents the depository institutions from on-lending any of those credit from the Fed to affiliates. Second, viewed ex ante, the existence of central bank lender of last resort facilities creates, obviously, moral hazard, incenting banks to take on more risk than they otherwise would. Third, viewed ex post, central bank lending can create risks for taxpayers. Central banks are smart, but distinguishing an insolvent bank from an illiquid but solvent bank is challenging, particularly in a financial crisis. And as we saw in the crisis, insolvency is a leading cause of illiquidity, and illiquidity is often a leading indicator of insolvency. For all these reasons, I think that bank liquidity regulation is a good idea and that the Basel III liquidity rules are an important part of the global regulatory reform program. The Basel liquidity rules for global banks do have and should have both microprudential and macroprudential purposes. The principal microprudential purpose of the LCR is to reduce the probability of a banking firm's liquidity insolvency over a 30-day time horizon through a self-insurance regime of holding enough high-quality liquid assets, HQLA, to meet short-term stressed funding needs. The principal microprudential purpose of the NSFR is to ensure that global banking firms have a stable funding profile over the longer one-year time horizon. Another primarily microprudential purpose of the Basel III liquidity rules is to create a level global playing field across national jurisdictions. The Basel capital rules create a level global playing field for bank leverage. The Basel liquidity rules create a level global playing field for bank maturity transformation and liquidity risk. But the Basel III liquidity rules also help accomplish macroprudential goals, such as improving financial stability by reducing potential fire sale externalities and reducing the probability of SIFI failures. I thought I would move next to a brief discussion of the limits of the Basel III liquidity rules. Although these rules are critical to the financial stability efforts of global regulators, it's important to recognize that these rules do not ensure that there will never again be a liquidity failure of a large global financial institution. They should help make such a failure much less likely, but they can't reduce the run risk of a bank to zero. It's important that we understand what these global rules don't address, and I have eight things I wanted to mention. First, the rules only apply to internationally active banks. They don't apply to broker-dealers, to non-bank lenders, to asset-backed commercial paper conduits, to money market mutual funds, and other aspects of the shadow banking system. Second, the rules don't address maturity mismatch inside the LCR's 30-day window, or between the LCR's 30-day line and the NSFR's one-year line. Third, the rules require a global bank to have liquidity adequacy on a consolidated basis, but they don't ensure liquidity adequacy in each legal entity or branch of the firm. Fourth, the rules don't address potential currency mismatches. Fifth, the rules impose effectively no penalty on matched books of repos and other kinds of securities financing transactions. Sixth, the rules include in the definition of what counts as a high-quality liquid asset, HQLA, some assets of pretty limited liquidity, including covered bonds, municipal bonds, and private label mortgage-backed securities. Seventh, the transition path for the global rules, which were effectively born in 2010, is a fairly slow transition path. Under the international agreement, the LCR phases in from 2015 to 2019, and the NSFR becomes effective in 2018. And finally, the rules treat the stability of central bank lending rather favorably, given the Fed's current discount window policies. I list off all these limitations not to implicitly criticize the rules that Mark Zaidenberg created, but rather to help remind us of what liquidity risks in the global financial system the Basel rules currently cover and what they don't cover. So what should be done about some of these limitations? The Fed and global regulators have a lot of work still in train in the liquidity risk mitigation space, and I thought I would just close by touching on a few strands of that work. First, the Basel Committee recently proposed some amendments to the NSFR. These amendments are fairly wide-ranging, but they include provisions that would address two of the limitations that I just mentioned. The proposal would require some amount of stable funding for certain short-term extensions of credit by banks to non-bank financial firms, thus introducing a meaningful regulatory charge on some forms of the securities financing transaction matched books. The proposal also would draw a six-month maturity line for certain purposes, thus reducing somewhat the cliff effects from the LCR's 30-day line and the NSFR's one-year line. Second, the Fed and the other U.S. banking agencies, in their proposed rule to implement the LCR in the United States, decided to go super equivalent to the Basel standards in a number of ways. The proposal accelerated the American LCR transition path so that the largest U.S. banking firms would have to be in compliance by 2017 instead of 2019. The acceleration reflected the substantial improvements in the liquidity position of U.S. banking firms and a regulatory desire to prevent any backsliding in the meantime. The proposal also excluded from the HQLA definition certain relatively illiquid assets that count as HQLA in the Basel standard, namely the ones I mentioned before, covered bonds, muni bonds, and private label MBS. Moreover, the proposal addressed maturity mismatches inside the 30-day window for the largest U.S. banks. And finally, the proposal did not permit U.S. banking firms to treat standard overnight discount window lending by the Fed as stable throughout the entire 30-day window of the LCR. The public comment period for the U.S. LCR NPR has ended, and staff is analyzing comments. Third, numerous Fed principals, including Chair Yellen and Governors Trullo and Stein, have indicated that addressing residual risks from short-term wholesale funding markets remain one of our principal unaccomplished financial reform goals. As Governor Trullo has indicated, the board is considering a variety of policy actions to address these risks. The policy actions include capital surcharges for SIFIs tied to their short-term wholesale funding usage, further changes to the capital or liquidity rules applicable to banking firms, and minimum margin requirements for securities financing transactions. Fourth, we need to admit that we can't intelligently regulate every liquidity risk faced by global banks. There remains, and always will remain, a critical role for firm-specific liquidity risk supervision. Supervision of bank liquidity risk can help fill in the understood gaps and weaknesses of the regulatory regime, and just as importantly, can help mitigate some of the idiosyncratic liquidity risks that individuals' firms face that no regulatory regime of general applicability can efficiently cover. In addition, supervision is our first line of monitoring and defense against attempts by banks to arbitrage around the new rules. Let me close by acknowledging that we need to recognize that the science of liquidity regulation is new. It's new to regulators, it's new to banks, it's new to the financial markets. As with any fledgling science, we are certain to go down a few unproductive paths as we move forward. We will have our Ptolemaic epicycles and our Lamarckian evolutionary cul-de-sacs along the way. We need to attend carefully to the impact of the new rules on banks, markets, and the economy in good times and in stress times, and we need to be willing to change the rules in the face of new learning. Thanks again for the opportunity to participate.
Good morning. Thanks, Doug, and thank you to Brookings for inviting me to participate today. I frequently in this situation would start my comments by saying something about perspective as an insider. I no longer get credit for doing that anymore, notwithstanding Mark's comments. So I'll just say that I wanted to offer a couple of perspectives from an active participant in the development of liquidity regulation. I want to take just a minute to sort of look back, at least I think of it as looking back, to the development of the LCR in particular and what some in some ways what we can and cannot infer from that, and then spend a couple of minutes sort of looking ahead. I was tempted to start my comments today as sort of in defense of the idiots, but I actually think Mark has done a really credible job of defending the idiots, and so we can continue that conversation later. I think it's... That was a compliment. That wasn't...
I wasn't sure if I'll go back.
Sorry. Just to be clear, that was intended to be a compliment to Mark, not anything. It should not have been inferred as something else. being one of the former idiots. That was my point.
Yeah, I sent some self-flagellation.
Yes, so anyway. I think it's helpful to reflect on the objectives in the development of the liquidity regulation within the Basel Committee and outside. And I say objectives plural, not just because, as Doug and others pointed out, there are multiple objectives about reducing the risks of the externalities associated with the failure of a large systemically important institution, as well as the fire sale risks. But it won't surprise you all that when you get together representatives from 26 different jurisdictions by the time we were done, of over 45 agencies and other onlookers, that describing the single set of agreed upon objectives is a little bit challenging. I will say that trying to navigate that collectively, I think it's fair to say the Basel Committee, notwithstanding that, or inclusive of the observations that Mark had about the limits of the Basel Agreement, I think could sort of be seen as coalescing around a view that requiring firms to have ex-ante self-insurance, not for all risk, but risks up to a degree, without reliance on public sector support, for the reasons that have been described of mitigating the risks of failure, for mitigating the spillovers associated with fire sale, is sort of where the committee coalesced. I think one of the challenges, as I look back, though, in relation to the subject of the conference today, is that that design has led some people to infer that the intent was to never have banks rely on access to specifically the discount window or more broadly public sector liquidity support. And that's where I think there's a giant leap from saying something about a policy design and ex-ante incentives, and then to describe the LCR as being a depiction of how different actors in the economy should behave conditional on a crisis. So again, I think the point that what I would like people to take away from this is that with respect to access to public sector support, and very much in relation to the first panel's discussion, I don't believe the liquidity regulations, even with their limited recognition or non-recognition of public sector support, should be seen as a statement of there is no role for public sector support, there is no role for discount window or the lender of last resort. It's a distinction that's drawn between the ex-ante incentives in terms of designing a public policy and then how you expect firms and the public sector to behave. So let me change gears a little and say, from my perspective and looking ahead, so where are we? Clearly, as Mark outlined, efforts to address those two core objectives of the spillovers associated with the distress of a large systemically important institution and the fire sale risks still exist in terms of as policy objectives, the continued discussions around the net stable funding ratio and short-term wholesale funding more broadly are sort of focused on that. I think, though, what I would observe is that there's another current running through the policy debate, some of which came up this morning and some of which I think is acute if you get to spend time watching the Basel Committee and even the U.S. regulatory process, is there's a perspective on what are the trade-offs between, and sometimes it's characterized as complexity versus simplicity, other times it's characterized as risk sensitivity versus something else. I'm not sure what the other side of that is. So I choose to sort of split the proverbial descriptions and say there's a trade-off between trying to be risk sensitive and try to have something that is simple. And where one thinks you want to fall in that balance is very much dependent on a range of factors, including how well one thinks you can design a risk-sensitive framework, what you think the unintended and intended consequences of a risk-sensitive framework versus one that is simpler and may create unintended distortions in the markets. And we were talking last night, or even this morning, I'd say characterize regulation is intended to distort markets, consistent with Mark's point. The question is, are you creating the intended distortions or are you creating some of the unintended distortions? So having said that, I think there's a real challenge when it gets to liquidity regulation that funding markets, this is not rocket science or terribly innovative, funding markets tend to be very complicated and have a lot more activity going on in them than I think some of the simple policy tools would give them credit. So I think that the wave of simplicity, particularly within the Basel Committee but elsewhere, has led to an affinity for some of the simple solutions to addressing liquidity regulation, without, I think, the appreciation of how some of the simple solutions may have unintended consequences. They may have some of the intended consequences, but they will also be associated with some of the unintended consequences. So what's the response to that? Because what I just said is sort of true of almost any policy debate. And so I think one effort that's going on now that we, Ernst & Young, are involved in actually with Clearinghouse and a number of institutions that are represented in the room today is trying to deepen the shared understanding of the activities that are going on within wholesale funding markets so you can have an informed dialogue around the policy debate. I would characterize generally if you're going to have a policy debate, there's, broadly speaking, there's two views you could have. One is that you have participants who have different objectives. That's certainly possible, a possibility, or different views about how to solve it for those objectives, for the differences of objectives. The other is there's a perception gap about to what degree you have addressed the objectives you've achieved. And so in that way, I think having efforts to deepen the understanding of the activities that are going on in a given market is a valuable one. The survey that we've been conducting and have shared the results with the Federal Reserve and others is an effort to enhance the data collection that is there and get an appreciation that the nature of the activity in wholesale funding markets is going to influence the types of risk that we described. So if you consider that, the world is not, as some would characterize it, simply the wholesale funding world is not simply made up of financing inventory and matchbook financing, and that's the end of the world. There are other activities that are being conducted, quite a few activities being conducted within wholesale funding markets, where if you can deepen your understanding of what those activities are, the nature of the risks of those activities in terms of their objectives, but then also how the risk has been mitigated. So the information, the data that are being collected relate to the business purpose, what's the nature of the type of activity, but then importantly also what's the nature of collateral that's being financed through different channels, what's the tenor of that collateral. And I think if we could get to a point where there's a shared understanding of the activity, then at least we could narrow the debate to we have a different view about what the objectives are. And that would be a better situation, I think, for all of us, rather than a fundamentally different idea of what is the world we face or how far have we gone. So let me stop there and turn it back to, I think, Adam.
Well, good morning. I'm happy to be here, and I'm a bit humbled. There's a lot of great minds in the room, I'm sure I'm not one of them. I hope that with respect to liquidity policy, I can bring a little bit of a unique perspective to this discussion because I'm an active practitioner. If I asked for a show of hands of people in the room that have responsibility for a Fed account and knew how much was in it last night and knew how much is supposed to be in it tonight, my guess is mine might be the only one. So I think I bring that. The other perspective I might bring after listening to the panelists today, I guarantee not to use words that have more than three syllables, because as bankers, we just don't understand that. So first let me say that even though I'm from a bank and a G-SIB at that, it might surprise you to understand that I'm a strong proponent of banks having an ample amount of liquidity. And I think this was informed by having a ringside seat and being responsible for managing the liquidity of Wachovia right during the height of the crisis and from the day that we announced the merger with Wachovia. And it was simply astounding to see the amount of liquidity that was consumed in a short period of time and astounding to see what we had to do to stop that. So I come with a healthy respect of runs. Benefit lately by that respect. Even when we had the debt policy or the debt ceiling debates in the fall and in the spring, we had minor market disruptions. But it was really good to have a huge balance at the Federal Reserve. Maybe that's my internalization of Charlie's admonition that cash has some value. I am a strong proponent of liquidity. But having said that, I think there are some things about liquidity regulation that we can do better, and I'm going to talk about several of those. First, I think there are some things that are proposed in the LCR that really need to be fixed, and I'm hopeful that in the revision that's going on now, we will address those. Second, we absolutely have to make conscious decisions to keep the process simple. And then finally, I think I would agree with Mark that we have not done a good cost-benefit analysis. There is a cost to having too high a stock of liquidity, and we have not explicitly considered the trade-offs. So let me say a bit about some of the current issues I see in the proposed LCR. I'm just going to focus on a couple. The first is a treatment of the way municipal deposits, collateralized municipal deposits, are handled that has the effect of requiring high-quality liquid assets to be held for the entire amount of the deposit, rendering it useless. The other part of that, another element of municipal finance, is that municipal securities are assigned no liquidity value. Okay, so as a sector, then municipal finance, this creates strong disincentives for any bank to be in the business of financing municipalities. So I think that is one thing that has to be fixed, and it simply doesn't reflect the behavior of either the deposits or the assets during the crisis. And I'm probably wasting my breath on this next point, but I just have to say that the limitation on agency securities in HQLA is just not based on observed market data. And the limit really should be eliminated. So I think that through the clearinghouse and others, the industry's done a pretty good job of presenting a limited number of things that we think are important to be changed, and I'm sure Mark will be very attentive to each and every one of those. So my second point is that the administration of the LCR is becoming increasingly complex. And Mark, if I understood it correctly, described it as simple. As a practitioner, I might take a different view of that. Let me give you some examples of that. So every day, Wells Fargo has to submit 20,000 data elements on liquidity to the Federal Reserve, 20,000. There's a new requirement that we think is coming out in January that our estimate is that will increase by 4 to 5 times. Okay, that's a lot of data to be pushing through. And while some of the data elements absolutely need to be evaluated on a daily basis, big security settlement flows, things like that, there's a lot of things that really just don't need daily attention. I think another example of this is kind of the increasing complexity of the rules. So one test that we have to apply to determine operational deposits requires that we evaluate 8 separate criteria for each deposit and then try to quantify those. And while I think you could argue that there's intellectual correctness to all those criteria, at the end of the day, it's important to realize that we're trying to estimate customer behavior. And that's always going to contain some degree of imprecision. So I think there's a false precision that we're trying to apply in the rules. And my point of this is not that I object to the work or the cost. It's that this process is growing increasingly complex without any certainty that the complexity increases its efficacy. And I think from my experience, I'm inclined to argue just the opposite, that when there's the presence of a lot of complexity, efficacy is actually decreased. And then my final point is that from an outside perspective, as regulations like this are written, you can see that when the authors are faced with a decision to make a balanced choice or perhaps a conservative choice, it's easy to take the conservative choice. I understand that. But what I think is not explicitly considered in this process is the cumulative effect of this, of all these decisions. So the LCR has a number of things that are a number of conservative choices that are pretty easy to identify. The assumption that all outflows occur on day one. Arbitrary limitations on the amount of contractual inflows that can be counted. Zero liquidity value ascribed to municipal securities, as I described. And an asymmetric, is that four cylinders or four syllables? I may have just violated my rule. I can't use asymmetric. The unequal treatment of operational, including operational outflows, but not any inflows. I was kind of relieved to hear that Mark Flannery can't find a serious study of this. I haven't found one. I found some that are online that seem to suggest that there really is no cost to excess liquidity being held by the banks. And I, as a practitioner, I can assure you that's just not the case. So I think in conclusion, I think we're on the right track. We have to have some liquidity regulation. It needs to be strong regulation. I think we may be heading down, what cul-de-sac were we in?
Lamarck.
The Lamarckian cul-de-sac. I'm just quoting him. Those aren't my words. We may be in the Lamarckian cul-de-sac at the moment in some of these areas, and I think we have an opportunity to be on better track by addressing some of these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to Brookings for having me and for the Clearinghouse for sponsoring this terrific event. I want to say at the outset, my remarks do not necessarily reflect those of Mark VandeWide or J.P. Morgan Chase, for that matter. What I wanted to do was just briefly review that a lot has been accomplished in this space, that more is being done. But in response to some remarks David Wessel gave us last night, talk about some things that I think should be considered. And then I think reiterate some of the points that Paul made, at least thematically, about there are implications. So a lot's been accomplished. Capital's doubled or more so over the last several years, and it's going higher. The CCAR process is firmly in place, and it is one that allows the Federal Reserve to leverage quite an extensive stress testing mechanism to ensure that banks' capital does go northward in direction, not southward. Leverage is sharply reduced in the system, probably by a third by many estimates, and that's welcome. Increased liquidity. I was hoping Charlie was still here. I don't see him, but he threw out a 20% number for his reserves at the Fed. Well, he may be interested to know that in the case of our firm, we have over $500 billion of high-quality liquid assets, as defined in Basel, and that that's on a balance sheet of about $2.4 trillion, so roughly about his 20%. Capital and liquidity are both stressed internally. I think that's an important part of the supervisory toolkit to encourage banks to do internal stresses as well as the well-known external stress of CCAR. Many are probably not familiar, Mark, with CLAR, but that too is an important stress mechanism. It's evolving, but forcing banks to engage in a very structured liquidity stress exercise. So more is being done. Structural liquidity, Mark, you lamented a little bit about the 2018 implementation, for example, of NSFR, an important structural liquidity measure, but you'll be happy to know that many banks are already compliant or planning to get there a lot in advance, and that's a good thing. It's part of the overall toolkit, and it's in contemplation, but some type of debt shield in the context of orderly liquidation to facilitate single point of entry resolution is probably in the works, both domestically and globally, and that will aid us in the overall amount of resources that are available to facilitate a resolution of a financial institution should it get in trouble. Intraday credit in the tri-party repo market reduced by $1 trillion. We've imposed intraday limits here, and so this is also a welcome development. So we're becoming very fortress-like, we, the industry as a whole, and it's increasingly hard to see how banks won't be in a good position to deal with the next shock or severe stress. But more could be considered. So five examples of things that, Mark, you and others might want to think about if you're not already. You mentioned standardizing haircuts. That's something that we think would make sense. And I think there's already work. The FSB has done some work in that area, and that could be expanded. Introducing an interim tenor measure between 30 and 365 days. We do that internally, and Paul, I'm sensitive to the complexity concerns you have. These rules are complex, even though intended to be relatively simple. But an interim tenor might be something that bridges the concerns that you all have rightly about these types of gap risks. Increasing availability of repo clearing for liquid assets. That's done in the dealer community today, that and work is being done to think about more extensive use of repo clearing, and that could be an important part of the overall mechanism for addressing concerns about short-term wholesale funding and fire sales. This one, I think, is an interesting one. It's something we do internally and should be considered more broadly, incorporating stress market capacity analysis and defining your liquidity profile. We do that. We think about what the potential is for being able to liquidate assets in stress and what that might mean, importantly, for our capital position, not just whether we could, you know, there's market capacity to dump securities, but what at what price and what might that mean for our capital. So in the previous panel, people talked about the importance of connecting liquidity and capital, and we think that's one way to do it. I will share an observation that Paul had, which is the U.S. proposal for LCR really is takes this to a one-day giant stress, the way it's structured. And you have to ask the question, gee, could you really liquefy your, as much as you might have a big stock of high-quality liquid assets, could you really liquefy it if the measure is really one-day stress? And that ties into the market capacity issue. And I think the answer is probably no, so we have to really think about that. And finally, ensuring appropriate policies and requirements apply to all significant market participants, not just bank holding companies, we think is an important part of this. All of this comes with implications, of course, and I just wanted to mention a couple, and Paul has rightly mentioned a few as well. Beware the drawbridge. We now have the concept of a bad deposit. It's not something we used to think about before, but given the definition in the LCR in particular, distinguishing between operational and non-operational deposits, we now have a bad deposit called a non-operational deposits, and banks won't want to take those. They certainly won't want to take them, especially in stress times, and it raises the question, you know, can banks be a safe haven in the next crisis? And it also raises the question, well, where will these deposits go? Will they go to money market funds, for example, because they're meant to be short-term? But as, you know, the SEC is considering changes to money market fund rules, what about potential gates and all that, and how will these things intersect? And by the way, funds need to be shorter under SEC rules these days, while financial institutions need to be longer, so we're not issuing the paper that they would want to buy. So where will what will they buy with these short-term deposits? So important questions to consider. How will the leverage ratio and the liquidity requirements interact? Bank-provided liquidity backstops become very unattractive in the new regime. Will banks be less committed? We provide committed lines of credit, but will we be less committed? Paul mentioned municipalities, CP issuers, definitely adversely affected. You know, the pricing, in conclusion, the pricing structure and availability of products and services will change, which might require important adjustments by wholesale consumers of our products and services. And we may be okay with this, the collective we, but as other panelists have observed, Mark and Paul, we're not sure this has been studied in its entirety. So a lot of important changes. We've improved the resiliency of the system. More is on the way. More could be considered, but we should try to understand the implications insofar as we can. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. So let's just get ourselves mic'd up here and we'll...
So but before we go to the audience, I just have a couple questions for the panelists from things that arose over the course of your various discussions. I do think one of the central points that we could probably all agree on is it would be useful to have a better cost-benefit analysis of these liquidity requirements than we have to this point. It's not that none have been done. The Basel Committee on Banking Supervision has done analyses of this as they put together the liquidity rules, but I think we'd all agree that there's a lot more that could be done. So I'd like to ask you about that. Two points. One, none of us have yet really addressed the point of what's the societal value of maturity transformation. I happen to personally think, as I think most people who follow banking do, that it's quite useful to take short-term money and turn it into something medium to long-term that can be used in the economy. But I've talked to serious economists in international organizations in the official sector who aren't sure there's all that much value in it. So I'd be curious about your views, how you think of it, and then what your thoughts are on the kind of cost-benefit analyses you've seen to date and what more might be done. So I'll give you a chance first, Mark.
Okay, I probably will skip that second question. It was a little too metaphysical for me, but I'll go on the first one on the cost-benefit analysis. Cost-benefit analysis is pretty hard to do, both on the cost side and the benefit side. We try to do what we can when we issue individual regulations to size the cost that those would impose on the banks that would be subject to them, the financial markets and the economy more broadly. We try to quantify the benefits to the broader financial system of the rules. But both sides of the ledger are pretty difficult to quantify. We also try to take a look pretty carefully at the intersections from the different rules that we're imposing. We're obviously imposing lots of different kinds of rules on different sets of banks. We're trying to look at the potential positive and negative synergies between those rules that come out and to measure those to the extent that we can so that there's so that the interactions are also taken a look at pretty carefully. But these are difficult things to do. Part of the way that we attempt to quantify the cost side for all these regulations, and this is done in Basel and is also done internally at the U.S. agencies, is we do fairly extensive quantitative impact studies of the potential shortfalls that different banks would have to the new capital rules, to the LCR, to the NSFR, to the single counterparty credit limits that the Basel Committee just put out. So we do attempt to quantify the somewhat more quantifiable side of the ledger, which is the cost side versus the benefit side, through that work. We also spent quite a bit of time internally trying to figure out what would be the cost to the U.S. banks that are going to be subject to the LCR. There's lots of different ways to come into compliance with the LCR. You can term out your liabilities. You can hold more HQLA. You can cut your credit lines. But we did a bunch of work internally to attempt to assess how much cost it would impose on the current banks that would be subject to it. The benefit calculations are just pretty difficult to do. So the work there tends to be a little bit more qualitative. The Basel Committee, as you mentioned, did do an assessment a few years ago, tried to do kind of a pan-regulatory assessment of the capital rules, and at least the NSFR, if I remember correctly, part of the liquidity program, took a look at the impact of that, measured the cost and the benefits as well as they could through economic models, and decided that the new capital regime and the NSFR were well within the range of social welfare increasing. And in fact, you could add a couple more percentage points of capital on top of what we've done, and it would still be net beneficial, even more beneficial to the economy, perhaps, than what we've already done. It's one study. The numbers are hard to get super comfortable with because of all the uncertainties around it, but we do the best we can.
Okay. Anyone else?
Sure. I mean, I think that I actually think Mark understated the challenge of doing the cost-benefit analysis. I remember when I was still part of the Basel Committee when these studies were being done, and even when you can measure, let's say, the direct sort of cost to comply, what you're seeing there is the commercial cost, sort of the private cost, to comply with a regulation. And on the better days, the appreciation on the cost-benefit analysis is one of the social cost versus social benefit, right, where I think the measurement error, not measurement, the measurement uncertainty is even greater. I know that I had a renewed appreciation of the challenge that the environmental economists went through, because I, at a time when I was in a position to largely be arguing for policies that were promoting financial stability, I would much rather have been, if it was just a debate, on the side of the debate that said the immediate cost to economic growth outweighed the benefits of financial stability, because it's easier to observe, it's easier to project the immediate cost than the uncertain and hopefully unlikely benefit of promoting financial stability. So I think that as we think about how to understand better the costs and benefits of. It's not as simple as just saying, well, we need to do better cost-benefit studies, but really to, if we can, deepen almost at a tactical level, what are the impacts of what's happening, and then make what is admittedly a judgment, a shared judgment, of whether those are the right outcomes to, a few of you have heard me use the phrase, the intended outcomes versus the unintended. There's going to be, and David made this point last night, there's a set of intended outcomes. If we understand those, we can decide, are the predicted outcomes within the intended class or in the unintended, in ones that we'd say in a judgmental assessment of the social cost, social benefit, are not the ones we want to pursue.
Adam? Yeah, just a couple of comments. I think it would be helpful in the policymaking process to, insofar as possible, be upfront about what those intended consequences are, because sometimes you only find out after going in and reviewing the proposal and trying to assess what the impact might be and providing that feedback, and they say, well, that's what we, you know, that's what we really wanted, and but it's not obvious in all cases that that's the case. So it's not clear to me, and I again, align myself with Paul on the issues around munis. You know, is it clear that we want to have some effects on the way municipalities manage their deposits or issue their debt? And so I don't know. Maybe that was an intended effect. The other thing, in fairness to the supervisory community, it's very hard to know up front what the response function of the banks will actually be. And so that's a very difficult position for them to be in. And it's the sequencing of the process that makes it so hard. The supervisors come up with a proposal. They issue it. We get it. We try to analyze it. We talk to our business folks and finance and risk folks and try to assess what the impacts might be. And then we project back to the supervisors what those impacts could be. But we haven't yet taken the actions. That we haven't really thought through alternatives, et cetera. So we don't know whether there'll be alternative providers in the marketplace such that there will be a net zero effect on municipal issuers. So that's all very hard to do. And Mark, you struck a chord with me earlier when you said we have to be thinking going forward in a way that lets us evaluate what the impacts are and make adjustments as necessary if we don't get it right up front. And that we want to believe as bankers that that is really an evergreen process and is easy to do. But I think, you know, some of the comments Paul made and some of the observations I've shared with you, it's hard once the policy gets, you know, fixed to change it sometimes. And so I think loosening up that the reins on that might make it easier for us to adjust if we can't readily predict up front what the all the impacts would be.
I'm not going to let you off the hook quite that easily. Since you do set up a major bank, and I'll ask you as well, Paul, what do you think the impacts are going to be? How are banks going to be reacting to this set of changes?
Right. We will change product structure, pricing, and availability on certain products.
What are the major areas where you see that having a real impact?
I think certainly in the area of lines of credit, liquidity backstops, and in this context, there are other impacts from the capital rules and so forth that are confined to liquidity. There's no doubt that, you know, because the rules take a harsh view of liquidity backstops, for example. And so if you're a CP issuer or you're a financial institution looking, another financial institution looking for liquidity from, a G-SIFI, that's going to be much harder to come by going forward. It will either not be available or be priced radically different. That may be an intended consequence, and it won't surprise me to hear Mark and Mark say that's an intended consequence, but that's definitely true. There will be adjustments required by the consumers of those products. So I think that's absolutely an area where deposits is another area where I think you will see a big change. Their deposits may end up getting termed out. They may get eschewed. We'll have to see. But if I were a corporate treasurer, I'd be thinking a lot about what these rules mean for me and trying to talk to my bankers about how things will change.
Paul?
Yeah, so let me go back to the cost-benefit analysis. I think we need to spend more time on that. I think that gets short shrift in the process. And I think it's subject to the super kind of a super equivalent mentality, where I think the agencies may put things out there that are intentionally conservative or have intentional impacts that aren't explicitly communicated. I think it would benefit the dialogue as a whole to be more explicit about that, because then we won't waste our breath if that's an expressed intent kind of thing. The other thing, though, on industry, industry needs to tone down its super equivalency, too. So every regulation, industry's first response can't be the world's going to end. And that frequently is the case. And so while it's easy to sit up here and say, I think a conscious decision to spend more time on the evaluation as opposed to the implementation would be a very useful thing. As far as the impacts, look, it's pretty simple. Adam summed it up. We're going to keep more cash on the sheet, period. And some of the changes are going to be really beneficial. I, as a practitioner, a lot of the contingent liquidity instruments that were issued probably never should have been issued in the crisis. And so I think that keeping cash, either prohibiting those or keeping cash sufficient to satisfy those should they be drawn, I think is a good thing. On the other hand, it is going to increase kind of the cost of credit and the cost of risk taking, because if you just take the simple balance sheet, you have less of the deposits to deploy, and you're going to end up with more cash, which is a drag on returns. And so far, we have not seen the capital markets drop their returns anywhere near commensurate with the increase in liquidity in equity requirement. The idea might be, well, we're making banks safer and the return requirements should decline and there'll be an equilibrium. So far we haven't seen that, right? We've seen equity requirements go up, which has the impact of obviously reducing return on equity, but risk premium for equity has not gone down by anywhere near the amount that equity requirements have gone up. So I think that's a problem. It hasn't sorted itself in 4 or 5 years, and so I think the outcome of that is probably an increase in pricing and more expensive or less available credit.
Could I pick up on one comment that Adam made earlier about back to the cost-benefit analysis? One way that we try to improve our cost-benefit analysis is to put proposals out for comment. The Basel Committee does it, the industry comments, the public comments, and then the U.S. implementation also always involves at least one round of public comments. So that helps a little bit, I think. But I think there is this fundamental point that Adam made that some of these regulations, it is hard to predict exactly how the banks that are subject to them or the financial markets more broadly are going to react. So you need to kind of watch and learn. And I think there's at least some good signs on the liquidity regulations that the regulatory community is willing to watch and learn and change. We put out the LCR in final form in 2010, made it effective 2015, I think was the original effective date. We amended it in material ways 2 years later, 2.5 years later, before the thing even went into effect, due to additional learning, additional conversations we had with the industry and the public at large. So I think on the liquidity regulations, we've recognized and need to continue to recognize that this is stuff that's new, and we need to be very attentive to potential unintended consequences, and I think we have been, and we will continue to do that.
Okay. Now, I notice none of you have touched the broader question I asked, which is, why should anybody who isn't in the industry care about these rules in the sense of, is there a real value to maturity transformation for society as a whole? Is it good that there are people who want to put deposits and know they could get it back any time, and yet we also want to use that money for medium to longer term projects? And can you just give me some sense of how you think about that, or is this something you're just not focused on? Anyone? It does tell me something, and I've run into this before, and it does worry me. Now, I will say for the benefit of the audience, almost everybody who's focused on financial regulation thinks maturity transformation has significant value. The economists I talk to who seem more skeptical generally have not focused on the area. But the fact that there are these real, that I can ask this question and people are reluctant to answer, is a concern. It makes the cost-benefit analyses harder, too, obviously, if you're not quite sure
what the benefit is to society in the first place.
Well, I'll try a Main Street view, right? So I'm sure I may get some eye rolls from the academics here. But look, when we lend to a customer, so we are primarily a commercial bank, all right? So we take deposits. Our customers have a clear preference in the way they choose the deposits that we have available to them for liquidity, right? So the customers are expressing a preference for liquidity, no doubt about that. Certainly commercial customers are that way, and retail customers are as well. On the other hand, on the asset side, when you're lending to small businesses and they want to build a building that may have a useful life of 20 years, they want to have financing that is going to be predictable for that 20 years. And so I see it played out every day in the choices that our customers make, both on the asset and the liability side. Now, theoretically, can I quantify that? Nope, but I can tell you that I see it in practice every day as we go about the business of gathering deposits and making loans.
Well, I guess I'd add that the observation could be, Doug, in the fact that the banking industry, though prone to paroxysms of it's a lot of syllables, Paul, sorry. Despite the episodes we have, has contributed significantly to economic growth through time. And so the idea that we would transform savings into productive credit and assets for that support economic growth, I think, has been validated over and over again. No doubt in the United States we've developed capital market functions that are a substitute for banking, and I think many parts of the world wish they had the capital markets that we do, notwithstanding some of their challenges. But the banking model has proved very successful in promoting economic growth, and I think that we should take that as validation point number one and deal with some of the issues that that come up through the structure we've created to deal with the episodes we have where there's crisis of confidence through insolvency risk issues, et cetera. So.
Yeah. Well, it'd be good to continue the conversation later, but I'll just say briefly, I certainly believe that banking has been useful for society despite the paroxysms, but there are multiple things banks do. They pool money together. They have informational value where they acquire customer relationships, et cetera. And they do maturity transformation, and I'm probably missing a couple other things they do. So the issue really is to figure out how much of the value is coming from the maturity transformation. I suspect quite a lot, but until we can nail that down more, it makes it all a little bit harder to talk about.
So, I mean, I think this was, for me, this was always the challenge in part of some of the cost-benefit analysis, because frequently the discussion would be phrased in not just the 0-1 question that you asked, is it valuable or not, but can we differentiate the good maturity transformation from the bad maturity transformation?
Yeah.
And what I can tell you from a policy design perspective, any time that, then maybe this is demonstrates that I'm a little bit of a chicken, but any time that the debate was framed in those terms, that's the conversation I was trying to avoid. The conversation I think we tried to actively get in is the one that was framed the way you and Mark teed up the question, which is, if we know that there are two really core forms of externalities that are associated with liquidity, you know, distress in liquidity in funding markets. One is the potential failure, and as Charlie was saying, it is related to a solvency question, but I think there's some challenges in trying to link the two, but it is related to that there's just externalities associated with financial distress of an institution, and the other is the fire sale externalities. And so a lot of the design discussion turned into trying to understand the nature of what would make a financial institution more or less resilient. And so you could say implicitly as well, it had the effect of being this sort of evaluative or what are more and less valuable. This is where something that was Mark said at the beginning. I would try never to describe the intent of the policy as reducing the amount of maturity transformation. I would frequently go with the intent of the policy was to address the externalities. It had the effect, in many cases, of putting pressure on what could be, for the purpose of this conversation, characterized as the less valuable maturity transformation.
And I think that's a reasonable way to view it. I guess one reason, and I'll turn to the audience in just one second, but the reason I keep coming back to this
is perhaps it's been bad wording on the part of some of the regulators out there, but sometimes they seem to talk as if every form of maturity transformation was a bad thing. And I doubt that's what they seriously mean, but it does, again, create confusion. So let me turn to the audience, and again, to expand on David Wessel's ground rules, please identify yourself and your affiliation, as people have been doing, and you know the difference between a question and a comment, so try to make it a question. And, Bert, you can't be the first guy every time, so, Krishna?
Thank you. Krishna Guha, formerly with the New York Fed, now with ISI. I do think in the conversation one aspect emerged that I think is struck chord with me, which is I do think that regulators need to have a conservative bias because every other actor in the process has a bias in the other direction for very reasonable and rational purposes. So that itself doesn't trouble me. When we look at the question of short-term wholesale funding, I wanted a specific question. There's an expressed policy intention that Mark van der Weide referred to address this issue further going forward. There are a lot of different tools that could be used to do that, some of which you briefly commented on. I would be interested in the panel's assessment of what the sort of optimal mix of those tools would look like if we were tweaking different dials with the purpose of making further progress to reduce vulnerability to short-term wholesale funding runs.
I assume you're going to duck, Mark?
I'd love to duck. I'll just say some meaningless words, and then you can turn it to these guys for something more intelligent. So I think, you know, the first effort that the global regulators took on short-term wholesale funding was really the LCR and the NSFR. So the first set of tools that we uncorked were bank liquidity regulations. I suspect that the primary reasons for that would include such things as tailoring the solution to the problem. If it's a liquidity risk problem, a liquidity regulation might be the most narrowly tailored solution to that problem. If it's a loss absorbency problem, maybe a capital rule is the right fix to the problem. So I think there's some tailoring benefit there. I think secondarily, there was a recognition that, you know, I think you could make a decent argument that the capital rule could address any possible risk we might see out there, at least in the banking system. But there is some reluctance, I think, for the global bank regulatory community to try to solve every problem with the capital rule. There's already a lot in the capital rule, and maybe we should have a little more of a policy of regulatory policy portfolio diversification and come at different problems with different sorts of tools. So I think that was part of it, too. You know, we've not been convinced that the LCR plus NSFR is enough of a solution to the problems in the short-term wholesale funding market, so we're exploring additional things we might do kind of in addition to that on the capital side, also on the margin side. One clear area where any kind of bank regulation doesn't fully solve the problem is when you've got short-term wholesale funding markets are not bank-specific. Banks are gigantically important players in those markets, but they go well beyond the banking system. Our regulatory tools tend to be fairly bank regulatory. There's a couple new tools you've got now to get at the market-wide phenomenon. You've got non-bank SIFI designations that the FSOC can uncork. If there's some single shadow bank out there that's looking pretty scary, they can go out and designate it. But again, that's only a little piece of the problem. There's also the problem of systemic herds of classes of individual firms, like money market mutual funds. There are a few market regulatory tools that we now have. One is the derivatives margin requirements that Dodd-Frank created. I think those are kind of part of the program. We've also had authority to impose margin requirements on securities financing transactions for many, many decades. The FSB is now currently looking at whether that should be part of the global financial response to the short-term wholesale funding, securities financing business. So I think we're kind of looking at all different tools at this point, trying to figure out what that right optimal balance is.
Yeah. So, I mean, I this is a point I made ineloquently before. I think that as we consider the remaining risks, I think there are two criteria that we could use in thinking about what policies to pursue, which would be the exact wrong ones to use. The one would be we have a hammer, so let's hit things. And so I know there's this temptation, and Mark, this is consistent with what you said, of capital regulations. Capital is great for solving everything. It is a very big and painful tax. And I guess my concern is that, and it certainly creates incentives, it runs the risk of not being the right tool for the right purpose. And so at the risk of of violating Paul's concern and being characterized as someone who is pro-complexity, I would say I am pro-tailoring of rules to solve specific problems. The second is a pure sort of public, I don't even know how to describe it, a political science problem maybe, is, and this ties back to something Adam said, we should not be afraid to use tools that have otherwise been considered done. And I think there's a temptation in the policy debate to say, well, there are some things we have finished, and there are others that we are still working on, so let's use the ones we're working on to solve some set of problems. And in the same sphere of tailoring, I would say, in many cases, there's a right solution for the right problem. Well, whether you think it, if you have what you view as the right problem, then identify the right solution for that problem, even if it means sort of having to go back and break a few eggs and reopen policy that you otherwise considered complete.
Can I just address the conservative bias issue? I am with you that there ought to be a conservative bias. What I'm suggesting is that the unconsidered accumulation of a series of conservative decisions is what I'm concerned about, and it just needs to be explicit and considered.
Yeah. Others? The woman in the back on this side.
Michelle Wilkins with the Export-Import Bank. I wanted to see if Paul Ackerman could expand on a comment that he made that limitations of agency securities need to be changed. What in particular did you have in mind?
So there's a limit in the proposed rule. Agency securities are limited. There's a cap on the amount. They're known as level two securities, and there's a cap on the amount that can be included. So you've got these securities, and depending on your mix of other HQLA and level one assets, you can have a restriction that limits the amount of agency securities that are considered as liquid. And our assertion is that if you look at the market data and the performance of those securities during the crisis, they were indeed liquid. They were arguably as liquid as you can measure as many government securities. And so the limitation, we think, just isn't based on market data.
Our view, consistent with that, is if you don't want to get rid of it, if you don't want to eliminate a haircut, meaning treat them the same as Treasury, you can haircut the securities, but get rid of the cap.
Yeah.
Okay. Bert, why not?
thank you. Bert Ely, Banking and Monetary Policy Consultant. This is a question, I think, primarily for Paul and Adam, and that has to do with, again, coming back to the issue of deposits. Deposits represent the largest single source of bank funding, particularly for domestic institutions. And I'd be interested in hearing more about how you see the LCR affecting banks' appetite for deposits and what the impact of changes that are made by the banks subject to LCR in terms of their deposit gathering programs, what feedback effects that and spillover effects that's going to have to community banks, to banks not subject to the SLR. DLCR, or to put it another way, to what extent is this going to really cause distortions and unintended consequences in the deposit-taking market, which, again, represents the largest single source of funding of bank balance sheets? And then kind of a related question, is the LCR kind of a backdoor way of trying to impose the narrow banking concept on U.S. commercial banks?
You
want to
go first?
Okay. Bert, I think you're right, though this will affect, and I mentioned it in my opening remarks, this will affect banks' appetite for deposits, and we will work hard to distinguish what is considered operational versus not in the context of the rules, and we will have to adjust our offerings to reflect that. Now, what you might see is that banks change structure. So remember, the LCR is a 30-day measure. So perhaps you get what heretofore have been kind of demand-type deposits terming out. Mark might find that appealing. Policymakers might find that appealing from a stability standpoint, but it does change the nature of the deposit for that corporate treasurer and so forth. So they will still be offered, but they might change in nature, and they could change in price. But we haven't thought heretofore in such a semi-rigid way about what's a good deposit versus a bad deposit. Because if you have a bad deposit, you're going to have high-quality liquid assets
held against it, and that means you're not going to be doing something else.
By the way, just to be a little clearer, is this summary correct that the operational the non-operational deposits we're talking about are corporate deposits which are not necessary to maintain a minimum balance for their sort of day-to-day activities,
yes,
but are kind of voluntary
broadly
deposits?
Defined.
Yeah,
broadly.
Fair enough.
I guess my response is I'm going to disagree a little bit with Adam. I don't think there are bad deposits. There are different kinds of deposits, and there are deposits that have different value, but I don't think there are bad deposits. So might I change my structure and pricing and the way I comport myself as a treasurer if I have a lot of non-operational deposits? Absolutely. And that will have to get baked into the way those deposits get priced and valued to the customer. But I don't think I'll just speak for us. It's not going to change our appetite to take deposits from customers because it is a valuable function. A corporate treasurer that needs a safe pair of hands for $200-300 million, even if it is not operational, that's still providing a service to them, and we'll figure out a way within kind of the regulations or, you know, reasonable liquidity management to provide that service to that customer. So I don't think it's going to change our impact. As far as large versus small, I don't know that there's going to be a huge disparate impact. I think there are reasons why some customers choose large banks, particularly in the corporate realm, because of the array of services that can be provided to them that simply aren't available in some of the smaller banks. So I'm not sure we're going to see a tremendous movement between the two because the difference is in regulation.
Okay. And then, and maybe the distinction Paul's making between our views, nuance, and it has to do with the business model. We're a global banker's bank and a huge prime brokerage operation. So we're going to have a class of deposits that don't fare well under the LCR. And so, again, that's we're going to have to factor that into our thinking.
Okay, others? David?
David Schroff from the IIF, very interesting discussion. I don't think anything has been said really, maybe indirectly a little bit by what Mark just said about effects of these liquidity regulations on market liquidity. It's maybe been a little bit alluded to by the two Marks in talking about short-term financing transactions. But certainly one of the things the industry is very concerned about is the potential impact of the NSFR as currently proposed on market liquidity for equities and all short-term markets. I wonder if you could comment a little bit on that.
I can comment a little bit. So this might be in reference to the recent proposal by the Basel Committee to put effectively a required stable funding factor or a haircut on some of the reverse repos that some of the large banks have. You know, one of our fundamental ways in which we're not convinced that the LCR plus NSFR does all it needs to do to mitigate risks in short-term wholesale funding is because both the LCR and the NSFR are, until this recent proposal from the Basel Committee, were really completely blind to maturity-matched books of repo and sec lend, sec borrow. And while that might not be maturity transformation, it might be a maturity-matched book. It still feels like there's some pretty significant liquidity risks there, I think both from a microprudential and from a macroprudential purpose. From a microprudential perspective, it's not at all clear that we should expect the global bank that comes under liquidity stress to yank every single one of its reverse repos to all of its customers, platinum, gold, and silver. So I think there's some just natural, selfish microprudential reasons why we probably shouldn't expect complete inflows of that kind of short-term lending by broker-dealers. And then also just from the macroprudential perspective, even if you've got overnight repos matched with overnight reverse repos on the other side, a quick unwind of that book, if it's large in particular, is going to have some pretty negative financial stability effects. So we felt like one thing that needs to be done to kind of ameliorate some of our STWF anxieties is to impose some kind of asymmetry, some kind of a regulatory charge on that matched book. The Basel Committee put out a proposal a few months ago that would impose a 50% required stable funding factor on some of those reverse repos, those short-term loans. A lot of negative feedback on that during the comment process, and the Basel Committee We'll be taking a look at that. That'll be one of the key issues that they'll be taking a look at as they move to a final NSFR later this year, and we'll be actively engaged in that debate. It's been criticized as too high. It's been criticized as not risk-sensitive enough. It's a 50% charge, basically, for all reverse repos, no matter what their term, no matter what the collateral is. So we'll be taking a look at whether more risk sensitivity, granularity is a good idea there. The provision also carved out banks, so the interbank markets were left kind of free and clear, and it was really kind of bank lending to hedge funds that got hit with the 50% charge. There was some criticism of that, picking of winners and losers in the repo markets. So that'll be an issue that we'll be looking at quite a bit as we move to refinalize the NSFR later this year.
This gets into the trade-offs of simplicity and complexity, right? Because we're certainly not allergic to having stable funding against these types of assets, but they need to be adjusted for credit quality and the type of asset it is. Well, that means you're going to have to get more granular with respect to the rules, and that runs across purposes with the simplicity argument. So there's a balance in there somewhere that'll have to be found.
Okay, other questions? Yeah, back there.
Thanks. Tara Rice, the Federal Reserve Board. And within the Fed, the two marks are near heroes. So we've been talking a lot about this from a domestic perspective.
I'm sorry, did you say near heroes?
They are heroes.
Oh, okay.
So we've been talking about this a lot from a domestic perspective, as we should. But I'm just curious, as we have differences with Basel III and how it's been interpreted internationally, I'm just wondering if anybody has opinions on how, what may be some of the major differences as we come to implementation, again, across countries. I know one of them could be the definition of HQLA. Wondering if you had any other thoughts.
So the Basel Committee has paid a lot of attention in the last couple of years to making sure, as they write all of these new different rules for global banks to comply with, that jurisdictions are actually implementing them faithfully, both in the letter of the law and also in the implementation of the law. So the Basel Committee has moved quite significantly, I think, from being just a rule writer to being, I won't say a rule enforcer, but they definitely are spending a lot of time making sure that jurisdictions implement the rules faithfully. And I think the focus of the attention so far has been on the capital rules, and I think that's significantly because under the current Basel capital rules, there's a lot of discretion given to bank internal models and internal rating systems, which are obviously susceptible to quite different implementation by individual banks and individual regulators. So the Basel Committee's kind of been all over that issue in particular over the last couple of years. But they're also going to spend a lot of time trying to make sure that the liquidity rules and some of the other rules that have been adopted are implemented faithfully across jurisdictions. The way Basel agreements work, the way they've always worked, I expect and indeed hope they always will work, is that they are floors. So each jurisdiction is permitted under the Basel agreements to go super equivalent, as we like to call it. And each jurisdiction, well, some jurisdictions will do that. The United States has proposed to do that in some material ways. And we're still thinking about all those issues as the comments come in. Liquidity regulations, I think Mark might have a different view or might have the same view, but I'll be interested in hearing his view as well. One of the challenges of producing a globally applicable liquidity rule was the very significant differences in funding markets across the world. To me, at least, it seemed conceptually easier to make a capital rule apply to all global banks. More difficult, because of the heterogeneity of funding markets around the world, to come up with a liquidity rule that worked kind of for all global banks, all markets. But we did the best we could, and the Basel Committee will make sure that that floor is set, is complied with by all the jurisdictions around the world.
So I think the other challenge, I'm not convinced it's that much harder. Well, let me rephrase it. I'm not convinced it's that much easier to get a globally consistent capital rule, because I think the asset markets, when you get to things like the standardized approach, thinking that the risk of a mortgage is comparable in different jurisdictions.
Yeah, they're both pretty harsh.
It's a pretty generous step. But I think the challenge that is incrementally hard for liquidity is that there are few boundaries to institutions operating in multiple funding markets. And so I think it is of great importance that the committee actually find a way to promote consistency in the implementation of liquidity regulation. I think there's some operational observations that, as Paul said, the reporting burdens are high. I'm not sure if that's an unintended or unintended, that their burden is high.
Super high.
Okay, go with super high.
Go with super equivalent.
And then when you get differences across jurisdictions, it has a increment to that because having sat in a conversation once with another agency, we'll leave out which agency it was, and the intent was for two agencies, cross borders, to agree on common liquidity reporting. Everyone agreed it was the most important thing they could do, and the conversation started with, but you, of course, will agree to go with the reporting that we just put out in regulation. And the conversation, as you would imagine, didn't progress terribly well after that. So I think that there are high costs to not getting consistency from an operational end. The other is there are high costs, given the sort of flexibility in funding arrangements, there are very high costs if firms are not subject to consistent regulation, that they can, even with the FBO rule, you will see foreign banks can fund themselves in U.S. markets, and if they're not being subject to comparable regulation, we'll get very different funding dynamics between the domestic and foreign organizations.
Another problem with manufacturing a global liquidity rule was, you know, one of the key issues that we had to debate with and have debated and will continue to debate is how to make those rules interact with the central bank lender of last resort facility. And different central banks around the world have very different policies around how they do a monetary policy, how they do lender of last resort. And that was another challenge, kind of, to produce a globally common template for a liquidity rule.
Yeah. You had a question, Martin?
I'm trying to make sure there's not too amorphous, and maybe I'm pushing on the same string that Doug was putting on in terms of maturity transformation. But how much intermediation do you think should go through banks in our economy? We have a certain level of deposits. Deposits historically were quite unstable, and so we had deposit insurance, and we made that unstable liability to be quite stable. So now banks can lend against that, and they can lend long even though they're borrowing short. So that didn't seem to be enough money, so they went out and started looking for wholesale funding. They're getting money from money market mutual funds, or that sort of deposits also that are cycled through the money market mutual funds. So I'm a little surprised that the bankers here are so sanguine about these changes. You know, you can't use these forms of funding that are not stable. We're not going to lend you liquidity as a lender of last resort except under extreme circumstances. So I'm just wondering, where's the money going to come from to provide banking intermediated loans that are so important for, you know, companies, small companies, and so on. And is that, when you were making these regulations, did you do any kind of adding up and sort of say, okay, here's the amount of saving, here's the amount of deposits, here's the amount of intermediation? Is that going to be enough to finance growth, or did you just say, we don't care, we're just going to make it safe?
So, let me start.
Of course they said, we don't care.
Yeah. Yeah, secretly, the conversation was we didn't care. No, try to be serious. I think that there was an appreciation that you didn't want the safety at any cost and that you wanted to not interfere with stable maturity transformation. And so that's why, notwithstanding some of the comments earlier today, and even the questions about the deposits now, the LCR, for example, intentionally differentiates among types of deposits. So there is a strong recognition, I would say, maybe not a perfect recognition, because there is still an assumed outflow of insured deposits, but there is a strong recognition of the benefits of deposit insurance. And so the incremental cost from liquidity regulation on that form of absent deposit insurance, but with deposit insurance, stable maturity transformation is not what the intended and unintended discussion is not what the LCR was intending not to tax that type of maturity transformation. I think the hard part is then when you get to everything else. And I think there were two in the discussions then, there were sort of two ways one could have gone about this. One is to come to a view of sizing the right amount of maturity transformation, which had all of, I think, the cost-benefit, social cost-benefit challenges we described before, or to come to a view about there are significant costs of financial distress. the big takeaway from a lot of for a lot of us from 2000 to 2007 to 2009 is that we may have underestimated the cost of financial distress, at least within regulated institutions and maybe more broadly. And so I don't think we should be surprised that coming out of that, and maybe to David's point from last night, there's been an overreaction. So, but I don't think we should be surprised that there was an intent to move the lever and say on the trade-off of transformation versus financial stability, the pre-2000 point on that trade-off, not where we want to be. Pretty clear where which direction we need to go. And then to everyone's point, I think there's a good debate about over time, how do we determine if we've gone far enough, just right? The odds of it getting just right are I'll go for zero, but either not far enough or too far, and then have the willingness to be somewhat flexible over time. I do think there will be a market mechanism that provides some relief. I don't say this critically, but banks are very good at appropriately arbitraging the rules that exist in a way that allows the risk and the return to come into appropriate limit. In some cases, there is less appropriate arbitrage. Some of that is from exiting the banks to the shadow banking, and that's why I share Mark's view that there has to be a discussion, and that was teed up this morning, about what are the incentives to move activities outside of the regulated sector. But I hope the reaction we get is not that, how do we get, and this was David's point from last night, how do we get back to where we were? This was a big, very painful experiment that said we needed to move the needle. And I think that was the overriding perspective as we were going through it.
Martin, you expressed surprise that bankers were kind of more opposed to the rules. And I think Paul and I have highlighted some of the issues that we have with the specifics. But by and large, these rules reflect how we think about liquidity, both from a stress and a structural standpoint. And in fact, the binding constraints may not be these particular rules, but actually will be our internal liquidity stresses and the external type of CLAR type stress measure. So this is not inconsistent with how we think about the risks, and the crisis taught a lot of important lessons, and I think there's been a significant adjustment in how banks, at least this one, how we manage liquidity in the post-crisis world.
Just one add-on to that. Back to the shadow banking point, these rules are going to apply to global banks, and they're likely only to apply to global banks. Lots of the scary forms of maturity transformation that occurred that caused firms to collapse back in 2007 and 2008 weren't part of firms that were subject to bank regulation. More of the financial sector right now currently is under the bank regulatory perimeter. But there's no guarantee that it will always remain that way. One thing that we definitely spent a lot of time thinking about as we constructed this liquidity regime was, are we going to just put this severe constriction on this relatively small set of large global banks and just see the activity flow right out of them to other firms that aren't? Right, right. And so we tried to do some things to make sure that we're not just pushing the risk elsewhere into the completely unregulated space, which may not be at all better. One, I think, important set of things that we did and spent quite a bit of time negotiating in the past few years was a lot of the shadow banks that did engage in a lot of the scariest forms of maturity transformation back in the crisis were only allowed to do that because they effectively had a bank sponsor or a bank liquidity provider or a bank credit enhancer. And so part of the changes to the Basel III capital rules, part of the provisions that were put into the LCR and the NSFR were to make it much more expensive for banks, at least, to sponsor a lot of those shadow banks that engaged in the scary maturity transformation activities. So in the world that we're creating, it does look like banks will be able to still engage in forms of maturity transformation, more stable forms. Shadow banks will still be able to engage in those sorts of activities too, but there's just going to be much greater constraints on banks. I'd say much greater constraints on really big banks, greater but maybe not much greater constraints on the medium-sized banks, and less constraints on the shadow banks. But we're pulling the levers that we can to make sure that there's not quite the same sort of Wild West activity going out in the shadow banking system too.
Okay. Please join me in thanking the panel. We've come to the end of our time.